It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Ryan Sanders, candidate for the 19th Congressional District, going to be here talking about his run against Todd Platts. Also, Lou Prince, owner of Vintage Vinyl, a small business in Missouri, out near St. Louis, to talk about what it takes to create jobs, what would help him grow his business, and what he thinks we should be doing to encourage job growth. That should be an interesting discussion. And also, Auditor General Jack Wagner is going to be here talking about the charter school situation and the report that he just released. So some interesting guests this evening. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The health care, another thing we're going to talk about, the health care bill has survived a GOP attack in Michigan. So heads up, Twitter Tom, we are going to be wasting a bunch of our money, a bunch of our needed tax dollars because of your politics. I think this is a shot that should be heard, and I hope that sane heads will wake up. We'll talk about this a little bit later in the program. I gotta get it off my chest. I am so flippin' mad today. It took me an entire hour, Jake, to go 10 miles to get here. And why? Why did it take an entire hour to go 10 miles? I have no freaking idea. And you never know. By the time you get through these things, you never know what it was. There are no dead bodies laying on the side of the road. There are no mangled cars. There's nothing left. And I'm just so flipping mad. An entire hour. I figured I'd get here to the studio a little bit early. We get some work done. An hour. And, you know, this is one of those moments where I go, for the love of God, would some politician have just a little bit of a vision, have a little creativity, have a little thought for what 10 years in this area is going to look like, you dim-witted, puddle-brained flag monkeys? I swear, I am so flippin' mad. You go up and down this road, up and down 81, and the slightest little hiccup backs up traffic for 10, 20 miles. We're going to end up like the Chinese. 62-mile backups, 9 days to get into Beijing. Evidently, that's what our politicians want. They want this massive backup. They want pain and misery and all this suffering that goes on with sitting in traffic with these idiots who, oh, I need to be in this lane. No, I changed my mind. I want to be in this. No, wait, I need to be in that lane. And I would love to get out of the car and just smack one of these nitwits upside the head.
Well, once again, although one of the Democratic county commissioners in the county you live in, Rick, voted with them. However, it was the Republicans, and once again, what was their issue? Well, we don't think we can incur the expense. We don't want to raise taxes. Meanwhile, there's gridlock. in an interstate. Light rail is exactly what the capital of this state needs, and it wouldn't have been a huge project. It would have been, from my understanding, Carlisle to into Harrisburg to Lancaster. Would have been a good start, but again, the Republicans strike. Well, this isn't appropriate. This isn't appropriate for our tax dollars. Well, what is? Exactly what is to these Republicans? They act like they're there to make money. It's they treat the government like a bank.
You know, look, you know, I don't ask for an awful lot, but a little vision, a little common sense. That road, you go look up and down 81 at any time of the day or night, and there are a lot of vehicles there. One of the most heavily traveled roads for trucks in the country. Yet we're doing nothing to get the four-wheelers off the road. I would love to see a light rail from Carlisle to Harrisburg. I would take it every day. Even if I didn't want to go to Harrisburg, I would jump on it just to go. But here again, what we've got is we've got people who have no vision. They have no understanding of what 10 years is going to look like. And I'm telling you, if we have done nothing in the last 10 years, if we do nothing in the next 10 years, it is going to be that much worse. Because the traffic isn't going to subside. It's not. Truck traffic is only going to increase. Car traffic is only going to increase as the population grows and as more people take on driver's license, more kids become drivers. I'm telling you, if we don't do something, it is going to be constant gridlock. And you know, hey, that's good for me on this program. To be honest, while I'm sitting in this chair, I hope the traffic is all backed up so I can tick you off about having to sit in it. But, you know, I got an hour. It took me an hour to go 10 miles, and I have no reason to, I have no idea why. There was nothing on the side of the road. There were no skid marks that I didn't recognize. Nothing. There was just nothing. And when I go home tonight, 1 o'clock in the morning, I guarantee you going through that one construction site, right around 55, right around the 55 mile marker, I'm going to end up backed up there. Where it is every single day for a couple of miles, backed up because it's got two cattle chutes. And for some reason, everybody sees cattle chutes and, oh my God, I gotta stop!
And it's not just about passenger. I mean, you could expand that. One of the things that businesses look at is the viability of transportation.
Absolutely.
And if you can increase the capacity of your transportation system, that's a real plus for businesses to come into your area. But once again, and correct me if I'm wrong, when this several-year feasibility study was going on, the economy was in pretty good shape. That would have been the time to strike.
Oh, gee, you think back when we had money and back when, you know, you could have the vision? Because it's been 5 years now I've been complaining about this. 5 years. We could have had it done by now. So that in 5 years, as the roadways are filled up with people, you'll have a choice. But again, visionless leaders. Visionless. And you know, the city of Harrisburg and the state, you know, this is one of those kind of projects that the state or the federal government should have been saying, okay, you know what? We need some jobs. Let's build this. Give the people what they want. I talked to a number of people who say, you know what? If they had it, I'd use it. I got to drive into Harrisburg, pay $20 to park my car when I could take $5 to ride into the city. I don't have to have wear and tear on my car. I don't have to sit in traffic. Sign me up. But no. That would mean, oh, well, gee, we would have to have some forethought, some vision. Evidently, we don't. And, you know, I look at a lot of communities around this country who are doing smart things. I look at in Oregon, for instance. One of their congressmen, Earl Blumenauer. He's one of these guys who wants livable communities where you have bike paths everywhere and you have bike parking in places and it's a pedestrian type environment. Not around here. You know, even if I wanted to ride my bike into town, it ain't gonna happen. And if you do, where are you gonna park it? That's why when I go to D.C., you go to Washington, they got bike parking. In fact, they got bikes.
Remember that?
That you can borrow.
You can borrow.
Put your credit card in, take a bike, go for a ride, put it back in another station on the other side of town.
That's a unique idea.
It's about serving the public. It's about having facilities. It's about having services that, oh, I don't know, make my life a little bit easier. In fact, you know, I was looking at a couple of places. Washington, D.C. has a bike station. Salt Lake City has one. Seattle, a bunch of places in California. In fact, the one in, if I'm not mistaken, the one in Salt Lake City has a parking facility right there with a maintenance shop and a place for you to take a shower if you're all sweaty from riding your bike. I think that's brilliant. But you think we're going to do that around here? Not going to happen.
But yeah,
because we got all these Republicans, I don't want to raise taxes.
We don't have enough money to do the simple things. Emphasize. Solar power. Do things like we're talking about. Increase the viability of bikes. Things that do what? That reduce the amount of oil. That lessen our dependence on oil. But yet they're willing to spend trillions of dollars in wars to protect our oil supply. Go figure.
You know, I'm a firm believer in it. If you build it, people are gonna use it. And when we were down for the 10-2 rally there in Washington, you parked, you jumped on the train, dropped you right there, you walked a couple of blocks.
Great.
Didn't have to worry about parking, didn't have to worry about getting a ticket, didn't have to worry about sitting in all that traffic. Simple. And you know, I just can't. I'm dumbfounded at this area's resistance to progress. Look, folks, if you put that line there, you're going to take thousands of cars off the road. And even if you don't want to take the train, people like me, we do. You know what that means? That means I'm not in front of you. Or I'm not behind you, like the guy was beeping the horn and flashing his lights behind me. So that means you take people off the road. It makes traffic less for everybody. This is a common sense thing, but we've got visionless leaders, people who have no idea about anything beyond the tip of their nose. And this is why you need people who say, you know what, who think big, who say, you know, in 50 years, what is this area going to look like?
Well, you know, Rick, when you look at that situation, and I believe you talked against it. You know, the more I think about it.
Against what?
Term limits. Maybe term limits is the thing. You take away the political pressure to get reelected at some point. This would have been a good example. Let's be honest. The people who made that decision, the county commissioners, I understand that, but the county commissioners did that, so what? They didn't have to raise taxes, and they increased their chances of being reelected instead of doing the right thing again. If you have term limits, you don't have to worry about that. Do it reasonable. You know, give them a couple terms. Don't say one and done. That doesn't make sense. Give them a chance to have a footprint in government, and then it's your turn to let somebody else come in. It would take away all the wrong things about politics.
See, I still believe in the ballot box. I still believe, and ignorantly and naively, I still believe in the voter. And boy, am I an idiot for that.
But
I still do believe in the voter.
The problem is, Rick, you and I both know it. To a degree, I've heard this charge made, and the more I see it, it's probably...
It's team sport.
Not only that, it's a... an incumbent protection plan system. It's very difficult to knock off an incumbent.
But again, it comes back down to the voters. I mean, I'm sorry.
And you got to take money out of it long term.
But this
always comes back to money in politics.
But I just had to get that off my chest because it's been eating at me since this afternoon. And you know, the amount of time that I spend on that road is ridiculous. And if you, all I'm asking is, you know, just, I don't even want a huge rail line. Just a nice straight shot. It's there. All of the pieces are there still. All you've got to do is have the will and the courage to do it. It is that simple. Anyway, let's take a break. We'll be back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. We want the world.
advice. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Northrop Grumman has begun layoffs at Avondale Shipyard on the Gulf Coast. It plans to destroy 5,000 jobs and close the shipyard, despite a Navy announcement last month that it plans to keep Avondale busy with work. The AFL-CIO says another 7,000 jobs will be lost when the 5,000 Avondale workers are laid off. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says Northrop Grumman is taking advantage of tax loopholes that make it more profitable to cut those jobs than keep the facility open.
One nation is America. America is a union of 50 states. We are all united together in a common cause of trying to lift all Americans to a better life, to better lives for their children.
Metallic Lathers, Local 46's Bobby Ledwith on the One Nation movement. Ledwith says good jobs are what the voters want, and a big political surprise is brewing.
It's going to be a big surprise in November, and I think it's going to be reminiscent of Harry Truman in 1948.
On Wednesday, worker activists blew the whistle, literally, on what they call Rite Aid's health insurance scam. In New York, Los Angeles, and Bellingham, Washington, activists converged on Rite Aid corporate events to protest hiking health care costs to workers that are 28 times higher than the actual costs of the program. Are inmate laborers and prison workers recklessly being exposed to toxic materials through a government e-recycling program? Jesse Russell takes a look.
A new report on the website fairwarning.org reveals that electronic recycling operations at federal prisons have resulted in inmate laborers being exposed to high levels of toxic materials. One of the biggest recycling operations is in Elkton, Ohio, where Fair Warning reporter Myron Levin says the U.S. Bureau of Prisons has paid about $1 million to settle a grievance over hazardous duty pay. The settlement was paid to prison employees after being reached in October of 2009. The article comes just days before the U.S. Justice Department is expected to release a report that will allege federal prison officials ignored safety precautions. The allegations are being raised at eight federal prisons that use the for-profit government-owned corporation Federal Prison Industries. The Bureau of Prisons would not go on record regarding any of the allegations because the matters have been dubbed either pending or confidential.
While the jobs may only be seasonal, it is good news for some workers who have been unable to find employment. Last week we reported on a number of businesses upping their seasonal hiring, and today we have more to add to the list. Kohl's Department Stores has said it will bring aboard an additional 40,000 workers this holiday season, while UPS plans to add 50,000. In more permanent hiring news, American Airlines announced Wednesday it would be recalling 800 laid-off workers. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hard-working men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
There you go. There you go. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Today the president was out stumping for Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. And during his speech, he warned, quote, just this week, the president said, we learned that one of the largest groups paying for these ads regularly takes in money from foreign corporations. So groups that receive foreign money are spending huge sums to influence American elections, and they won't tell you where the money for the ads comes from. So, the president says, this isn't just a threat to Democrats. All Republicans should be concerned. Independents should be concerned. This is a threat to our democracy. The American people deserve to know who's trying to influence their elections. And if we just stand by and allow the special interests to silence anybody who's got the guts to stand up to them, our country's going to be a very different place. So, you know, I sat and I thought about this last night when we walked out of here, Jake. And this is an opportunity, I think, for the Tea Party people and people like us to come together. Because if you are a Tea Party supporter, you cannot look at this, even though it is your side that's benefiting. You cannot look at this and say, this is not destroying our country. You cannot possibly look at the fact that they're spending $75 million on attack ads. be it forever, whoever it is, that a portion of that money is coming from foreign interests. I mean, you can't look at that, Jake, and say, you know, that's okay, because they're helping my side. If it were going to the Democratic coffers, and countries like Bahrain and India and Russia and all these other places around the globe are giving money to help my side, I'm not for it. I am absolutely not for it.
Unfortunately, I mean, you and I both know why these foreign powers are shoveling money in here. They want people reelected, or they want to put new people elected that will forward policies that allow more and more and more jobs to come into their country and bigger profits. It's all about money. It's just follow the money train, and that means more jobs leaving the United States. And that's very distressing. I mean, it's bad enough that I think elected officials in this country betrayed our country. Now we're allowing our system to be compromised by money from other nations. Are you kidding? What other nation would allow that? When you think it's bad, it can't get any worse, Rick. It does.
You know, the thing that bothers me is, look, at the end of all of this, it's the multinational interests that are benefiting from all of this. It's the multinational interests, the transnational interests, who are dominating the globe. And it's not just here. You know, I got to be honest, I was against American corporations going into other countries and taking over there as well. We cannot have mega corporations who can dictate terms to countries exist. They are too big. They are too big for democracy. They're not just too big to fail. They're too big for the democratic process. And, you know, you go back and you look at the word fascism. And I know it's a charged word. It's something that, you know, people get all fired up about. But it simply is the melding of corporations and government. Is that what we want? Is that the kind of place we want to live in? Do we want a place where the trains run on time, but, hey, good luck with your rights? Is that what we're looking for? And the Chamber of Commerce and all this, you know, they're not going to – I guess they're playing from the Republican playbook. Deflect, avoid, and then attack. Because as Reuters pointed out today, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is mounting a new legal attack on the Obama administration's regulatory policies just weeks ahead of congressional elections, telling voters that Democrat-driven regulation is hurting the economy. So by going to Wall Street and saying, you know what, we're going to restrain you a little bit, not as much as you were when Glass-Steagall was in place, mind you. No, we're not going that far back. You know, we still need the money. But we're going to put a little restraint on you. They don't even want that. They're going to fight that tooth and nail. And this is what this fight is about. Tom Donahue, the chamber's president and chief executive, said on Thursday, the nation's largest business lobby is beefing up its staff so it can fight health care and it can fight financial reform in court. So this $75 million that they're blowing on ads to convince you and I to vote for their candidate, they're going to spend a boatload of money going after it in the courts. And why, you know, again, it goes back to what my grandfather always said, and it's as true as I'm sure when he heard it 80 years ago. If somebody's going to spend a buck, if a rich guy's going to spend a buck to tell you you don't need something, you better spend two to get it. Because that guy's not going to take money out of his pocket to help you. That's not going to happen. Nobody's ever done that. I've never had somebody reach in their pocket and say, you know what, here, I'm going to help you out, buddy. No. They've reached in their pocket because they knew they could get something back out of me. And that's what this is. This is a major screw job. And the global Chamber of Commerce. It's no longer the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. It's the global. It's the transnational Chamber of Commerce. And they are going to spend every penny possible to take back the Congress and the Senate for who? Not for the Republicans, for corporations. That's who they care about. They don't care about party. It's just right now the Republicans are their whipping boys. I'd use the W word, but I just, again, I can't afford the FCC fines. But, you know, well, what do you call giving somebody money for a service? I mean, they say it's the oldest profession in the trades, but, again, you know, what kind of, or am I missing something? Maybe the U.S. Chamber of Commerce really has the country at heart. You know, maybe the chamber really just, we just love America so much that we're going to take money from other countries to make America better. No, I don't think so.
No, it's not. It's catering to the whims of the big businesses within the chamber. I mean, that's sad. I still think, and we've said this before, but I certainly believe it to be true. They are turning their backs on the smaller businesses in the chamber.
I mean, you look at these idiotic trade agreements, absolutely idiotic, and they're pushing more of them. Oh, yeah, we need a trade agreement with Colombia and Panama and South Korea. Oh, yeah, we need these so we can have more job loss, so we can ship more jobs overseas, so our trade will be good jobs, what few we have left, for not so cheap anymore toasters, because they're not cheap anymore. The product's coming. I used to say it was cheap plastic crap from China. It's not cheap anymore. It's still plastic crap, but it's not cheap. What are we going to learn? When are we going to learn? This is not that difficult. If you don't produce something, you cannot survive. And what the Republicans have come out and said is, well, you know, the Democrats, they just think that manufacturing is just going to come out of the woodwork. And, you know, it's this myth that they have, that they've put up, that manufacturers are going to create jobs. It's this myth. But where'd all those jobs go that we used to have here? You know, I remember when I was a kid, the steel mills were still pumping. I remember we built a lot of things here. We were the world's producer. And you go over to Trenton, New Jersey, there's that sign. Trenton makes, the world takes. We used to produce. But we got this bright idea, and it happened during the Reagan years. We got this bright idea that we were above getting our hands dirty. Not all of us, just a small segment, the people who own the country, got this idea that, you know what, we don't want to make anything here anymore. We're going to ship it overseas where we can get really, really cheap labor. And then we can still charge the same price for the product, same price, because the U.S. consumer is going to pay that price. But what we don't have to pay is we don't have to pay those union wages. We don't have to pay benefits. We don't have to pay pensions or health care or vacation days or sick days or any of that stuff that American workers want and demand. We can go to a third world developing country and say, you know what? We're going to bring you jobs. And you're going to be able to feed your family just barely, make our product. Granted, you're going to make television sets that you're never going to see one in your home because you don't have electricity going to your home. But we're still going to bring the plant here. And we're going to ship that TV back to the U.S. And all of that difference between the wages and the working conditions and all of the difference in the environmental laws, that's going to go right to the bottom line. And the investor class is going to be very happy. And the CEO is going to get a huge bonus, big stock advantages, big cash payouts. And the shareholders, boy, they're going to benefit. And you know what they'll do then? They'll convince the idiot working class that these 401ks that are replacing defined benefit pension plans, these 401ks are in their best interest because they're shareholders too. You're one of us, guys. You're one of us. You're one of the investor class. You have stock. And we bought it. Hook, line, sinker. And it was the greatest screw job in the history of this country.
Well, if you want to revisit, and I remember it was a bitter, bitter fight in NAFTA in 94. And yes, the majority of Republicans voted yes. The majority of Democrats voted no. However, having said that, first of all, you had a Democratic president, President Clinton, and you had some very key, I still remember, you had some very key votes. I remember a couple of those votes. They were from blue collar Democratic districts, and they voted for it. The unions begged them not to vote for it.
Well, that's
and they gave us a message that one, We have to step up. We live in reality. We live in a world economy. Two, long term, or they didn't say long term, they said in the future, we will be able to sell to these countries what we make because we will be building up their economy.
Yeah.
Well, that obviously never happened because instead of building up their economy, they basically got raped by big business. Allowed them to pay him pennies on the dollar. They allowed them to ignore environmental standards, in some cases even human rights standards. And here we are.
Here we are.
Here we are 11 million jobs later. Some people believe it's more than that, and counting every day.
So the question is, where do we go from here? How do we turn this around? I say you need politicians in Washington who understand that working people need jobs, and we don't need more insane trade agreements. When we come back, we're going to talk to Ryan Sanders. He's a candidate for the 19th Congressional District. We're going to find out what his thoughts on trade are. We're right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
For many, the 8-hour day is standard, but it wasn't always this way. No, American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the large showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. Visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Keeping the Chambers of Commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show. You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts.
Well, there's one way to start the revolution. That's to vote some of these incumbents out, some of these guys who stood up for these free trade agreements, who have really put the screws to American workers. That's the way we do it. U.S. Representative Todd Platts, Republican, York. It has been reported on Penn Live, is not getting the top job that he wanted at the Government Accountability Office. You remember he applied for the job last year. Guess he really doesn't want to be a congressman. Anyway, recently the White House announced Gene Dodaro is going to be the Comptroller General. That is the post that Republican Congressman Todd Platts wanted. So I guess we're simply going to have to see him run for the House, and I guess he's going to have to stay there. That is, unless we can get him out. Ryan Sanders is the candidate who's running against him. His website, ryansanders.com. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you taking time for me. Well, I guess the first question I was going to ask you is out the window. He didn't get the job.
Yeah, no, he did not. Yeah. And you know what? We were just talking last night at a forum, and Todd said that, you know, a qualified person got it, but he uses this, was using this conversation as a way to show his bipartisanship. He said that Dennis Kucinich supported him, and he said that Michelle Bachmann supported him.
Oh, boy, there's a – yeah, I want Michelle Bachmann's endorsement.
I know. Well, my thought was, well, the reason those two guys are supporting you is because they think you'd be a good bureaucrat.
No, that's an excellent point. Excellent point. I saw this thing the other day that Todd got some Guardian Small Business Award.
Yes.
Is that, what is that?
Well, it's the National Federation of Independent Business that gave him that, and he did that a couple of times in his debate as well. And it's part of the unfortunate conversation we have been getting again from the Republican leadership in Congress. They keep using false goods to tell us what they want us to believe the truth. Because look, here's the story: in NFIB, give 98% of their funding to Republican candidates. It's a Republican talking point machine. The whole point of it is they're giving out awards trying to say, look, we support small business, when all they support are the big business politics that they've supported for the past 10 years.
You know, because, you know, I look at this and I say, I don't know that Todd Platts is the best friend that small businesses have had. I just don't know that.
He's not, because the policies he's supporting are the ones that help Wall Street. They don't help us on Main Street. The unfortunate fact of the matter. You know, it's small business that have 50 employees. It's small business that have 75. But if you watch, he actually will use this little twist in reality and say that the IRS says that half of small business income will be affected by extending the Bush tax cuts to the wealthiest. Here's the trick, though. Half of IRS income, if you count small businesses, you're including companies like Bechtel, which has a holding company, the largest construction company in this nation. Its holding company qualifies as a small business. But Bechtel as a whole has numerous different organizations in arms and reach. It has $30 billion in revenue a year. And they qualify as a small holding company or a small business. Same thing with the Chicago Tribune, qualifies as a small business. These aren't small businesses, but because of a tweak in the IRS system, they can be used that way. And so, of course, here's what Todd Platts and his leaders tell them to do. We'll call that a small business and it's IRS income, and the rich are being affected like the small are. It's a classic hoodwink that they're a bait-and-switch situation. They're trying to take advantage of the small business owner and give it to the rich.
Yeah, I've always thought that he was kind of that sly character to begin with. And that sounds like it. Well, let me ask you, you're a small business owner. You have been a small business owner. I don't think, was Todd ever a small business owner?
No, he's never actually worked for anybody but the government.
That's
the ironist.
That's what I thought. So, you know, I guess a small business owner would be the kind of a guy who might have some ideas on how to stimulate small business and how to maybe get an economy going.
Right. And I sure do. Thanks for asking, Rich. Because that's, you know, the key thing is, As a Democrat, you know, but you're always targeted that you're trying to create big government. That's not what we're looking for. Small businesses don't need more government. They need opportunity. And the trick is a couple things. We have a lot of organizations that are out there to help small businesses. Small Business Administration is a key one. It helps businesses connect with banks. It gives them training, gives them opportunities to get access to credit. That's what most small business owners need, because I was one of them, and a lot of the vast majority of small business owners cannot get access to credit from banks. So what they do is they use their credit cards. And we all know what the risk is with using a credit card. But there's no other way for a small business owner who has to claim self-employment. You can't get it from a bank. The banks won't give a self-employed individual a loan.
Yeah, they're too busy giving. They're too busy giving Norfolk Southern $250 million for 100 years.
Right.
You and I can't get a 100-year loan for less than 6%. $250 million for
exactly
100 years.
Yep, and that's where the problem lies. The rich keep the rich richer, and they keep giving each other loans, but they don't help the small business owner, the ones who actually are the innovators, the ones who create 65% of all new jobs. They don't give those guys the access that they need to build our country and make it stronger.
You know, you brought up the big government argument, and I don't care. I'll be honest with you. I don't care how big government gets, as long as it's effective, as long as it works, it provides the services that we demand. I'm not concerned with the size. I want it to be effective. I want it to be responsive. And you know what? I look at my local government in the Carlisle area. I would love to have a light rail, the Corridor 1 project that goes from Carlisle to Harrisburg, so I don't have to sit on Route 81, on I-81, for an hour to go 10 miles.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. One of the issues we have as a nation is the development problem. There's way too much suburban development and not enough concentration of ability to transport and travel. Everybody wants to have a car. That's part of what the United States is, and that's okay. But we have to look at reality, too. At a certain point, you have to have other options available. And it's, you know, the point is not to mandate people have to take transportation, but to have that option available, because if it's certain, we cannot afford to continually build more and more and more roads, because that's killing our taxes.
Yeah, but we're not even doing that. I mean, I look at 81, and 81 has been probably the same road for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's no innovation there, but we've doubled the amount of traffic over the 10 years.
Right.
We're going to double it again in 10 years. If we don't have leadership with, and I know this is a state and local issue, but even and the federal government needs to think this way. If we don't have some vision of what the future is going to look like, we are going to be gridlocked.
Yeah.
With crumbled infrastructure.
Yeah, smart growth is not a left wing or right wing issue. Smart growth is how you plan for a country that culturally has always thought, well, we can go west and just keep growing. But we've gotten to the point where development is hitting us, in areas where we never planned for it. So we need to be, as a community, focusing on a nonpartisan issue of, okay, well, how much do we want more of our land, our good farmland for one thing, paved over, and how much do we want, to sit in traffic. And if we don't start having that conversation, then saying our taxes are going to continue to go up, and we're going to lose the ability for us to actually function for get information and get economics of products through.
And from a business perspective, I mean, that's an excellent point. Who's going to want to relocate here? Who's going to want to build their business here if they can't get their products out? If the roads are always packed, there's no access to rail, there's no infrastructure, who's going to want to come?
Right. And because of where we sit in this area, it's a huge thing. Central Pennsylvania is a keystone, to use a cliche, because we're so close to Baltimore, because we're so close to D.C., Philadelphia, and we have that opportunity to make ourselves a cornerstone of industry and development. And we do have, you know, E1 is exactly that.
Yep,
Carlisle is exactly a transportation hub.
Yep.
But we have to protect that. We can't allow overuse of cars to block our rail access, to block our access to for trucks to move goods back and forth. So that means thinking intelligently about how we use our residential travel system. And I mean probably we need to put light rails. We need to encourage smarter growth within communities and not kind of build more sprawl. All those things are key things. And the federal government's job is not necessarily to force those issues, but it is to encourage the building of roads and bridges and those sorts of things more densely.
To lead the way with a little investment.
Right.
Just like the things I've been talking about with solar panels.
Right, exactly.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Ryan Sanders, candidate for the 19th Congressional District. RyanSanders.com is the website. You can get there from our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, Ryan, and looking at the energy situation, I sat on 81 for an hour today. That's why I'm so flipped off about transportation. To go 10 miles, and I have no idea why, but I sat there for an hour to go 10 miles, and I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I'm burning all this gas. It would be nice just to jump on, you know, on a rail and head there. And I'm thinking about energy, and I'm thinking about all the money that I'm sending overseas to people like Hugo Chavez and people like Saudi Arabia. And I'm going, you know, there's just so much opportunity here that the party of no has denied us from. There's just so much opportunity. I go back to the Reagan years when we were denied solar panels and to get off the oil, and I'm looking to now when the Republicans are doing the exact same thing.
Yeah, that's unfortunately the problem is if you look particularly since 1980, and that's a good starting point, the message has not changed. It's always been give more to the wealthiest few. And you know, the tax cuts that just came through in 2001 were exactly that. They actually gave the wealthiest 1% 40 times more tax cuts than they did average middle class individual.
Well, yeah, because didn't you know it trickles down? Did you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Haven't you been trickled on? I know I've been trickled on enough.
Yeah, if only that were actually the case. But, you know, it's been proven, and this is the thing that drives me nuts. We continually hear this stuff, this message, but it's not true. You know, economics and economists have shown that the rich are the ones who conserve their money. And here's the, you know, to make fun of this situation, I mean, the rich got rich because they don't spend the money.
Right.
So they're not going to spend the money when they have it. It's just like economic, the way the world functions, supply and demand. If you have more, you don't spend it because you have everything you need.
That's right.
The middle class, however, spend because they spend what they have to get what their families need, their children need, the food, the travel, whatever it needs to be. And if you look at the short-term results of the Bush tax cut in particular, you see what a failure it was. And one of the promises they made, George Bush in particular made, was that it would actually increase unemployment by cutting taxes. Well, if you look first of all, the first 3 years after the tax cut, we lost jobs. About 600,000 jobs were lost.
Yep.
If you look at the past 6 years after that, made maybe, I think it was about 4 million jobs were created. That seems okay when you look at it in the big picture. But if you look at the comparative period from 1993 onwards, and that's when taxes were actually raised, the employment rate actually jumped 16% over that same period, whereas in George Bush's period, it was only about 4%. So the tax cuts didn't do a thing. We had four times more job growth when taxes were raised.
Well, here's the thing, Ryan. Here's the thing. You got to understand, and I get this a lot from people. Well, who did it benefit? You know, who did it benefit? Well, it benefited the top 1%. Who was supposed to? It was never supposed to help us. It was a screw job, and we took it hook, line, and sinker. Let me ask you a last question I've got for you before we wrap up. You're elected November 2nd. What's the first thing that you do when you hit office?
First thing I'm going to do is focus on getting a bill sent to Congress that will limit the ability of money to be used in political campaigns.
Excellent.
And we need to do one that actually focuses on using money as a freedom of speech issue that actually passes this. This is a really difficult issue because money is destroying our political base.
Yes,
you know, the Wall Street bankers spent $2 billion since 2008 on our congressional candidates to make sure that they didn't pass a financial reform bill that hurt their interests. This is a problem. It's a huge problem. And we need to take money out of politicians' hands because if they cannot physically separate themselves from the distractions of money telling them how to vote.
That would be an excellent bill. I would be behind you 100%, and we would be helping you push that through. So let's hope November 2nd things go the right way. Ryan Sanders, candidate for the 19th Congressional District, RyanSanders.com. Again, you can get there from our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Ryan, always great to talk to you. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Great. Thank you, Rick. And tell everybody to come Monday on the 11th in York County. We're having a debate again with Todd Flatt at Dallastown Middle School. Thanks a lot.
Outstanding. Thanks so much, Ryan. We'll talk to you later. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
In California, a surprising new union movement is growing like a weed, having taken root in a burgeoning economic sector that has enormous potential. Marijuana. The Golden State was one of the first to legalize the use of medical marijuana, and a network of licensed growers, dispensaries, and other related businesses has since flourished. It turns out that pot is a labor-intensive product, and the producers, distributors, and retailers of weed have become something of a hotbed for local job growth. These workers, as in any other industry, need a unified voice to achieve a living wage, decent benefits, training, job security, upward mobility, and other elements of a shared prosperity that create a middle class. In a word, unions. In Oakland, the first step toward a unionized workforce for medical marijuana businesses was taken this May, when about 100 retail employees voted to join Local 5 of the United Food and Commercial Workers. With a depressingly high unemployment rate, Oakland officials cheered this introduction of good paychecks, which will allow families to spread their increased incomes through the local economy. Then, in September, Local 70 of the Teamsters Union added to Oakland's marijuana momentum by signing up about 40 gardeners, trimmers, and other skilled workers who were employed by a local business that contracts to grow pot for medical marijuana patients in the area. The Teamsters negotiated a 2-year contract with the business that provides a $7 pay hike, health coverage, paid vacation, and pension, the kind of jobs that can sustain a community. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, federal law still outlaws marijuana, but common sense state and local laws are showing that, by literally going to pot, such legalized grassroots enterprises can give people and their communities an entirely new high.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Yes, you're bound to lose. As long as you got people willing to stand up and fight back. Folks like in the chat room, I got Jay Rayborn there in the chat room. Thanks for being here. All you guys from the Horn, appreciate you sticking around for the program. Tomorrow, if you're going to be in the Washington, D.C. area, 1615 H Street Northwest, the Chamber of Commerce is holding a reception. It doesn't have a time, so we'll have to call and find out what time. But they're holding a reception for the Bahrain Minister of Finance, also the Central Bank, and the Bahrain Ambassador. They're inviting several banks from there, investment firms, and also targeting the manufacturing sector. So the people who are influencing our election, the folks from Bahrain, are going to be in town. So, if you're in the neighborhood, stop in. Say thank you for screwing up our election process. Thank you. Appreciate it. Oh, I'm still, between that and being stuck on the road, I'm still flipping mad. Just nuts. Just absolutely nuts. Have you seen House Minority Leader John Boehner? Boehner? Lately? Have you seen him lately? Does he look sick to you? I mean, he almost looks white. I mean, almost maybe, pale.
Maybe
he ran out of spray tan.
Well, no, maybe he's busy and he hasn't been able to get to his tanning sessions, Rick.
I don't know. He's looking mighty white to me. Must have lost.
Was that a pun on words, perhaps?
Maybe he lost his can of spray tan. Orange spray paint ran out of.
As the Bowery Boys would say, are you dissinuating something here?
Absolutely. because you got the president who says that Boehner's a person of color. Yeah, orange. A weird color. I've seen people who are tan freaks, people who look like used handbags, but he doesn't even look like that. He just looks like a glowing orange. Like somebody just spray painted him, or something that went an experiment that went horribly wrong.
He does look out of place in the middle of winter. And Washington, D.C. isn't exactly that far south. Middle of winter, there he is, tanned. Very much out of place.
Anyway, right before the recess this past week, the Senate passed a bill called the Interstate Recognition of Notarization Act of 2010. Wow, say that twice. that could have made it more difficult for foreclosure victims to challenge the banks who have improperly approved their foreclosure. So if you got thrown out of your house by one of these banks, by one of these banksters who didn't do their homework, this bill would have made it close to impossible for you to fight back. The legislation would have forced states to accept documents that were notarized in other states under potentially different sets of notary standards without verifying any of the documentation. The Senate bill, without debate passed, and despite widespread reports of foreclosure across the country being approved by banks, robo-signers, you know, they got people, somebody told me they had 80,000 of these go through with like 10 people. And they were just out there, you know, cha-ching, cha-ching, like factory workers, cha-ching, cha-ching, just pumping out the foreclosures without making sure that any of them were accurate. And, you know, I know somebody said, hey, you know, sign these. And then, you know, the guy, all right, I'll sign them. I don't care. I'm getting paid. Without verifying anything. And we find out that a number of them, a good number of them, were wrong. And these people lost their houses. Anyway, the president has said he is not going to sign H.R. 3808, the Interstate Recognition of Notarization Act of 2010. The bill will return to the House of Representatives, and hopefully they'll trash that idea. Because, look, we should be helping people stay in their homes, not helping banks throw people out. And like I said from the beginning when this happened, and again last night, was we should put people back to work by refinancing these mortgages. We need paper pushers back to work. Start refinancing them. Start giving them people lower rates with better terms. They're still going to pay for the houses. They're just not going to get the screw job that the banking industry gave them. It's that simple. And we hold up the value of everybody else's house by not having a ton of foreclosed properties in our neighborhoods and not having a glut of properties that these marauders come in and then end up renting out. That's what drives our values down, Jake.
Absolutely, and then you're forgetting another thing. I mean, if people can stay in their homes, I mean, you're stimulating the economy a little bit more locally. I mean, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. Unfortunately, that's not too many snowballs have been rolling downhill when we talk about banks. We talk about foreclosures. Horrible situation.
See, now I think the president should veto the bill. But he just said he's not gonna sign it. So it's basically a pocket veto.
Well, it's a pocket veto.
But I think he should make a strong statement. And this is one of those opportunities where you could make a strong statement. Look, I'm gonna stand by working people. I mean, you're not signing it, that's fine. But send a strong message. I am on the side of working people in this country. And I think that would do it. And then let the Republicans run around and go, see what he vetoed? I'd love to see them do that. Would love to see him do it. But again, if you're in Washington, tomorrow, over on H Street, the Chamber of Commerce is holding their reception for the people of Bahrain. You might not want to miss this. Can you believe that? When did the Chamber of Commerce become a global entity? Do you really think they give a rat's behind about American companies?
See, now to me, Rick, that's a big story, and I haven't heard a peep.
It's a massive story.
I haven't heard a peep locally. Usually these conservative talk show hosts that we have in this area here,
it's indefensible.
You know, they're in message.
It's
apparently that's not the message that they want out in the public.
It's indefensible.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's absolutely, and don't you just love the Republicans are first to wave the flag? What's happening with the chamber? Is this group is betraying this country.
We're right back after this. Stick around.
On the radio, with my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, you use my business hat. I'm on to 1 a.m. I must tell you that I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Northrop Grumman has begun layoffs at Avondale Shipyard on the Gulf Coast. It plans to destroy 5,000 jobs and close the shipyard, despite a Navy announcement last month that it plans to keep Avondale busy with work. The AFL-CIO says another 7,000 jobs will be lost when the 5,000 Avondale workers are laid off. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says Northrop Grumman is taking advantage of tax loopholes that make it more profitable to cut those jobs than keep the facility open.
One nation is America. America is a union of 50 states. We are all united together in a common cause of trying to lift all Americans to a better life, to better lives for their children.
Metallic Lathers, Local 46's Bobby Ledwith on the One Nation movement. Ledwith says good jobs are what the voters want, and a big political surprise is brewing.
It's going to be a big surprise in November, and I think it's going to be reminiscent of Harry Truman in 1948.
On Wednesday, worker activists blew the whistle, literally, on what they call Rite Aid's health insurance scam. In New York, Los Angeles, and Bellingham, Washington, activists converged on Rite Aid corporate events to protest hiking health care costs to workers that are 28 times higher than the actual costs of the program. Are inmate laborers and prison workers recklessly being exposed to toxic materials through a government e-recycling program? Jesse Russell takes a look.
A new report on the website fairwarning.org reveals that electronic recycling operations at federal prisons have resulted in inmate laborers being exposed to high levels of toxic materials. One of the biggest recycling operations is in Elkton, Ohio, where Fair Warning reporter Myron Levin says the U.S. Bureau of Prisons has paid about $1 million to settle a grievance over hazardous duty pay. The settlement was paid to prison employees after being reached in October of 2009. The article comes just days before the U.S. Justice Department is expected to release a report that will allege federal prison officials ignored safety precautions. The allegations are being raised at 8 federal prisons that use the for-profit government-owned corporation Federal Prison Industries. The Bureau of Prisons would not go on record regarding any of the allegations because the matters have been dubbed either pending or confidential.
While the jobs may only be seasonal, it is good news for some workers who have been unable to find employment. Last week we reported on a number of businesses upping their seasonal hiring, and today we have more to add to the list. Kohl's Department Stores has said it will bring aboard an additional 40,000 workers this holiday season, while UPS plans to add 50,000. In more permanent hiring news, American Airlines announced Wednesday it would be recalling 800 laid-off workers. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hard-working men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
What's going on?
You know, this week I got a study. I get a lot of these reports from different groups. And the group is Business for Shared Prosperity, their website, businessforsharedprosperity.org. Basically saying, look, you know, here's a common sense approach to creating jobs, to having a prosperous middle class, to growing our economy, that and creating one that works for everybody. So, of course, I had to contact them and say, you know what, I need to talk to somebody from your group, and they've sent me Lou Prince. He's a managing partner of Vintage Vinyl Incorporated, vintagevinyl.com, and I gotta read part of his website, because this is fantastic writing in my assumption. Tell them their background. The about page goes, Tom Ray and Lou Prince loved music, but thought most record stores sucked. In 1979, they decided to start a record store for music lovers. It would be a record store built from the customer's point of view. It would be a place where you'd find good music of all types, and people working there could tell you about it. Boy, wouldn't that be a nice thing to have again. But they didn't have any money to rent a store. Bummer. So they pulled about 300 records they gathered and rented a booth at a farmer's market in St. Louis, Missouri. They sold most of the records and bought more the next week. Pretty soon they were hauling a couple thousand records to the farmer's market every Saturday. That was the fall of 1979. So they moved up the street where they are now. Wow, 7,000 square feet "We'll never run out of room again," said Lou. The store was open lots more hours. Tom and Lou hired lots of employees. They started buying records and CDs. Pretty soon they opened a store in Granite City. Now they have two stores, and they're always out of space. How's that for progress? And you know what? That's the story of small business. That's why I've got Lou here on the phone with me. Lou Prince, welcome to the program.
Hey, nice to be here, man.
I appreciate you taking time for me. You know, I look at your story and I'm going, man, this is how you build a small business into something that hires people, something that benefits the community.
Exactly. Two people with no other marketable skills than hanging around talking about music figured out how to make a living at it. It's a miracle.
It is a miracle. And in this country, that's one of the great things, that you have an idea, you have the opportunity to go out there and do something. It's a great thing.
The key to a small business, to any small business, is that the business owner and the people who work there are doing something they love. My partner and I are essentially ex-musicians, and almost everyone who works for us is either a working musician or DJ. And so we preach the gospel of good music, you know, and sort of keep a staff together that'll do that.
Yeah, I identify with that. You know, back in my younger years before I got married and had kids, played in a band myself.
Oh, there you go.
There was a point where you go, well, can I make a living doing this? And can I raise the family? And, you know, it's fun to, you know, to go and play out, make a couple of bucks, drink, party, do what you do. But then you gotta grow up and become an adult, I guess.
Well, I'm in my 31st year of still not having a real job. So I seem to have escaped that.
Great for
and
you.
And I consider myself incredibly lucky. But this is the thing that these groups that lobby to keep taxes low on rich people don't understand, that you don't create jobs in a small business because of a little more profit. That what creates jobs in small businesses is people working there and people owning the thing who really have a passion for what they're doing. You know, both my partner and I could have made more money doing other things or working for big corporations. My wife is incredibly understanding about the limits that this business puts on her income. I mean, I do fine and I make a nice living, but there is an upper limit. And it's partly because we feel like we need to treat workers right. So we do things like pay for all their health care.
Wow, there's a novel concept.
Well, you know, this goes back to, you know, politics in this country. The single thing that government can do to make life easier for small and medium-sized business people is give us cost certainty. And the largest piece of cost uncertainty I have is healthcare every year.
Well, I've always said the number one thing that you can do for me as a small business owner is take healthcare off my back.
Right.
I'm not a healthcare person. I want to run a radio program. I don't know anything about healthcare.
Totally. I totally agree with you. And because we were two votes short in the Senate, we didn't get it.
Yep.
It's really what it comes down to.
And now what you've got is you've got people who, I've often said, and maybe you'll agree with me, I've often said if we could take health care off the small business person's back, you would see an entrepreneurial spirit in this country unmatched in the history of this nation. You would
absolutely
see people.
Agree. I absolutely agree. I spend, you know, our health insurance plan re-ups every December 1st. And I basically spend the month of October screwing around with three or four brokers and three or four different insurance companies trying to figure out how to make it work. And what I get every year, I have a relatively healthy, relatively young group, and I still see 12, 14, 18, 19% increases annually. And it's really hard to write that into a business plan because I got to make a whole lot more than that to pay for it.
That's
out of profit.
That's selling a whole lot of records over at Vintage Vinyl. The website, vintagevinyl.com. One of the things that I've been trying to get across here these last couple of weeks is that we keep hearing businesses need tax cuts. We need rich people need tax cuts. All this tax cut stuff. I keep saying that small business, they don't need tax cuts. Small business needs customers.
Exactly.
They need people. They need people like Rick Smith, who's been looking for the Blither Smith album for about 8 years now. Can't find it.
Email me with the info. I'll find it for you. That's exactly what we do. You're totally, completely correct. You know, I got involved with Business for Shared Prosperity originally a couple of years ago when they couldn't find businessmen who would fight to raise the minimum wage in Missouri, which was, I think, was $5.45 at the time. And we wanted to raise it to $7.50. And what I did was just went around the state saying to people, look, if more money was in the pocket of your average customer, you'd do better.
Yep.
And nothing puts more money into the economy than a tax cut, a tax break for working people. And nothing does less to improve the economy than a tax break for rich people. This classic tax breaks for rich people are classic trickle-down economics.
Yep.
And they have been proven to not work and not create jobs.
I think
period.
The best line I've ever heard is from a friend who's a professor over at the University of Minnesota. He said, if you give a middle-class guy a tax break, he's going to go out and maybe buy a car or a toaster or something like that. If you give a middle-class tax, if you give a tax break to a rich person, they're going to buy a congressman.
Yeah, and you know what? If you keep doing it, they end up buying lobbyist after lobbyist after lobbyist to get them more money without working.
Exactly.
Because these kind of tax breaks are basically money for not working.
Yeah.
You know, if I want my business to do better, if I think there's an atmosphere that will help my business do better out there, then I'm going to go invest up front in it. Right now, in fact, this week, I've spent most of the week preparing to go visit bankers. And it's to borrow an extra $40,000 or $50,000 to stick into the store in inventory for Christmas. And it's most, and I have to do this because without looking at my books, without checking my profit and loss statements, without noticing that in the 30 years I've been in business, we've never missed or been late on a loan payment, they cut my credit line in half when the market crashed in 2008 because I wasn't using it enough.
That's one that gets me all the time. Because I follow my credit score, and mm-hmm. my credit score dropped after I paid off a car payment. It
wow.
actually dropped when I had no more debt.
Right.
Figure that out.
Yeah, I still don't. I'm the other side of that, and I still don't understand it. And I don't understand why businesses use this as a guide. Now they're using credit scores as a guide to people's reliability as a potential employee. And the credit score yep. thing is a bad, bad game for working people.
Oh, it's a bad game all the way around.
One of the things, though, that's happened in the last few months is the Consumer Finance Protection Agency.
Right.
I just got an email today from one of my credit cards, Bank of America, MasterCard, or Visa, and it offered to a free balance transfer. It said free, and no interest on it for 2 months.
Wow.
And what used to be the tiny print at the bottom had to be in big print right next to it saying, we're going to charge you 4%,
well, it's 4% now.
Of the amount you transfer, and we're going to charge you 29% interest after the 2 months.
Well, at least they made the print bigger.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is they made it so obvious that no one in his right mind will take this loan.
At least you'd hope.
This is government working for us. This is exactly what the Finance Reform Act was about, the Banking Reform Act was about.
And it's
this is another thing that we see, these shills for the Chamber of Commerce, these shills for the National Federation of Independent Businesses and Manufacturers in Congress fighting against.
Are you sure you're a business person?
Well, you know, I come from a pretty good red diaper family. My dad was a union organizer.
Oh, there you go.
And he actually organized postal workers when it was illegal. There was a law called the Hatch Act, which made it illegal to organize federal employees.
Yep.
And my dad came home from World War II. He was in the first wave at Normandy and fought his way through France. And they gave him, as a disabled veteran, they gave him a job in the post office. And he took one look around and said, these guys need a union.
You know, I listen to people almost every day, and now this is going completely off the topic here, but I talk to people all the time who complain about their job condition. They complain that they're not being paid well. They complain that their health benefits aren't what they wanted. They complain, but it doesn't seem that the people in this generation are willing to take a stand and say no more, and I can't figure out why that is.
You know, I worry, to me, unions were an expression of the great American sense of optimism, that we can better ourselves, that my kids will have a better life than I have. And I really think that one of the things the control of our politics by money has done is suck the optimism out of regular people like us. they begin to believe that you can't beat the big mountain of money that's buying our public officials. And the fact is what unionism proved, what the trade union movement and the industrial union movements proved, is you can, but you have to organize. It's the numbers that can beat the money. And we're looking at an election right now where the money is all flowing in the wrong direction. And the only way to beat it is for all of us to go out there and vote. Go out there and get our neighbors to vote.
And all you hear in the media, all, the only media construct I keep hearing is, oh, my gosh, you know, the Tea Party is enraged and the Tea Party and the Tea Party. And, you know, you talk to these people and some of them are not the brightest bulbs in the box.
And it's the same 15 or 20% of people who are always, always angry enough to be fooled as opposed to angry enough to do something.
That is an excellent way of putting that. Can you stick around for a minute?
Sure.
I got to take a break right here. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with Lou Prince, managing partner of Vintage Vinyl. VintageVinyl.com is the website. We're right back. Stick around.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the 8-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, 8 innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. 4 of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You know, speaking of union organizers, today, back in 1879, the labor leader, songwriter, martyr, if you will, Joe Hill, was born in Sweden. You know, you still remember the day he was shot on that white chair in the Utah prison for doing what? For being a rabble-rouser, being the guy who stands up and willing to take the hit. Makes you wonder. I got Lou Prince on the line. He is the owner of Vintage Vinyl. VintageVinyl.com is the website. Lou, thanks for sticking around for us.
Love to do this, and you remember Joe Hill's last words, what he wanted people to remember him for.
Don't mourn, organize.
Don't mourn, organize.
Absolutely.
And wherever you are, if you're a working person in America, remember that the corporation is an organization of capital. It's the way people with money get together to make their money grow, and that the union is the organization of labor. And the balance in capitalism is to balance the power of labor with the power of capital to get a fair deal for both.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that we try to talk about on this program is that when this country had the largest growing middle class in the history of this nation. You had a unionization rate around 35%. Mm-hmm. And look at the inequity that we have between the very, very rich. And I'm not talking, you know, people making $500,000. I'm talking people making $10-20 million a year and having wealth that most of us can't even imagine. And then people who don't have anything to eat.
Right. And now you see Newt Gingrich attacking food stamps.
Yeah. That's, you know, disgusting.
This is the example of a perfectly balanced government program. Food stamps came in during the Depression. As price, they were administered by the Department of Agriculture as a way to support prices for farmers who were pouring out milk and throwing away corn because there was no market for it because consumers, the customer, the average person didn't have money.
And again, you know, you take that lesson that you've just laid out, move it to our situation right now. I mean, you know, we're not in the middle of a depression. Well, without the elasticity programs,
right.
Like food stamps, unemployment, maybe we would be in an absolute depression.
Exactly. And the jobs that didn't get lost because of the stimulus are the depression you don't see. It's policemen, firemen, teachers who retain their jobs because the government was willing to spend. You know, at interest rates today, we should not be afraid to borrow our way out of this. I mean, you're talking about government bonds, and this is what, when the government borrows, it issues treasury bills.
Right.
Are selling at less than 1% interest. If your 30-year mortgage was at 1%, how much better a house could you build for your kids?
Or how much money could I have in my pocket to consume other products?
Well, what I'm saying is we can get a 30-year mortgage on our new infrastructure, on improving our schools, on making the entire country broadband accessible and wireless, on making public transportation work. This is our chance. This is the opportunity. And this tax break they want to give the rich will take $700 billion away from that over the next 10 years. $700 billion that could go into investing in the country.
You've done my job for me. I mean, that's, you know, basically what we've been saying here. Look, folks, it's pretty simple math. And all I keep hearing from the right wing is that, well, if we don't give the top-tier tax breaks, small businesses making over $200,000, couples over $250,000, they're going to be harmed by this. And I ask you, as a small business owner, I'm sure you've got to be somewhere around $250,000 in revenue, right?
The company takes in a couple of million bucks a year. What we end up taking out of it, my partner and I have never taken home $90,000. This year we took a 20% pay cut. Because business is down because there's a recession.
Right.
In order to make sure we could retain everybody and keep the health insurance. This is the way most small businesses are. When you hear about small businessmen that are making $250 and above, what you're mostly hearing about are boutique, law firms, doctor and dental offices. Those are small businesses.
Hedge funds.
Or the big scam in this small business thing is the numbers that the Republicans throw in are the numbers of LLCs and S-Corps. What these are ways that really rich people can protect and pass income through without paying corporate tax. Okay, so what they're doing is escaping paying corporate taxes, getting categorized as a small business for federal, you know, enumeration purposes, but are essentially really rich people who own tons and tons of these S-Corps and LLCs. You know, the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team is an LLC owned by about 10 of the richest guys in town.
Wow. So basically what you're saying is you've got a business makes over $2 million a year as a business.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be affected by this. Because what we keep hearing, and this is the mean I keep hearing, though. This is what I keep hearing. Since you make $2 million a year, your business makes $2 million a year, you're going to be taxed on everything over $200,000.
That's completely wrong. Basically, I get taxed on what comes to the bottom line after everybody gets paid, after all my suppliers get paid, after my employees get paid. And what comes to the bottom line is a very small number.
And
that's the amount I get to reinvest next year in my business.
Right.
Okay? The taxes on that are actually tiny. Most years, we're in a 15% or lower bracket for our corporate taxes. And it's not by, you know, finagling the depreciation or the books, because basically we're in the used record, used CD business. So what we have is two banks worth nothing, and categorized by the government in the tax forms as basically nothing.
Right.
So it really is real money passing through. We end up, for us, the reason to create a job is we think we can do more business. And you put that money in up front, and that money comes off your taxable income. So when the Republicans tell you, or when these shills for big business tell you that that money goes, that the money that they don't pay in taxes goes to hire someone, they're doing it at the wrong end, and they don't know how to run a small business. They're guys who've never run a small business. They're lobbyists.
Good point.
Small business puts the money in at the front end.
Let me ask you this. Are you, as a small business owner, are you a member of one of the lobby groups, the Chamber of Commerce, the yep. National Individual Business, whatever, an IBF?
All of these groups really represent much, much larger interstate businesses. They're really owned by companies like Walgreens. They are, and in fact, in today's news, there was a big piece about the $10 million that the Chamber of Commerce is throwing at Republican candidates for Congress to use against Democrats, which may be coming from foreign businesses
yep.
who want these guys to go to Washington to make it easier to outsource our job.
Yep. And it wasn't just 10
less patriotic than the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Well, here's the thing, and this is what I've been saying all night. I didn't know the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was a transnational corporation.
Yeah.
And they're going to spend $75 million this cycle getting Republicans elected by using money from Bahrain, India, Russia, Dubai, and Egypt because they all have AMCAMs in those areas.
Right.
And I got to tell you, there has got to be an investigation into this, and there's got to be a stop, because this is, in my opinion, not only illegal, I think it's almost treasonous.
Well, exactly. This is the attack on America that we never look at. You know, terrorism isn't a serious big problem. They're just criminals. The real problem is organized world capital trying to create a very poor working class that they can exploit. That's really what we're looking at. And we're looking at a moneyed class that doesn't understand the ultimate repercussions of that are bad for everyone.
Well, they don't care. It's how American business is done. And I'm not, you know, bashing on you, but it's the next quarter. It's that next bonus.
Well,
it's
see,
the tip of the nose.
Yeah. See, companies that have to answer to the stock market essentially put themselves in the position of having to make every quarter look good. The guys who have made really serious money in the stock market, guys like Warren Buffett, never look at it that way. What they look at is the long-term growth possibilities and opportunities that the company has. And the quick buck artists who have essentially taken over the financial system since the 1970s don't care about the long-term growth of the company, of the economy, or the long-term health and welfare of the people working in that company. You know, they call them corporate raiders in the 70s and 80s for a reason.
Yep.
They were raiders.
It's hooray for me and screw you.
Exactly. And what these guys want to do is give a tax break to the guys who make the most money doing the worst things to our economy.
Yep.
Wall Street CEOs will get a tax break. Big-time arbitrage bankers will get a tax break. The guys who we bailed out and didn't even have the decency to thank us just kept saying, well, we deserved it. We keep your economy going. We're going to get this tax break.
Wow. And, you know, the thing is you look at those Wall Street traders and the hedge fund people, they pay less in tax than the guy swinging a hammer
yep.
or the guy driving the truck or doing whatever because they've
right.
got a capital gains tax of 15%.
Which the hidden message in that is that work is less valuable
yep.
than investing. And it's the wrong message for a country of essentially middle-class and working-class people. And again, it is a product of a political system that is totally skewed by money.
Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Lou Prince. He's the managing partner of Vintage Vinyl. VintageVinyl.com is the website. Any record that you want, I'm sure he's got it all. Just check out the Vintage Vinyl website. Let's get back onto the point. I got about a minute and a half here left. What do we do? What do small businesses want? What should the Obama administration be doing to help you? I keep saying we need demand. We need people
right,
to have money
demand.
In their pocket, a little coin. They're gonna buy records. They're gonna go to movies. They're gonna do things that people can profit from.
For this recession, we need a new deal. We need a new CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, which back then built the national parks, should be doing environmental projects. We need a new NRA, a new National Recovery Administration that will build infrastructure in America, that will fund education in America. You know, we know how to run great schools. The upper crust of American schools produce the most creative people and the best educated people in the world. What we don't do is get that down to the bottom third of the economic scale in America. We need to invest money in our infrastructure. We need to invest money in our schools. We need to invest money in our future. And that money will create jobs, and those jobs will be people walking into my store and the neighborhood grocery store and the neighborhood shoe store and making my business work, making my small business work. We really need national health care in this country in the worst possible way. We are absolutely uncivilized in that regard.
I absolutely.
We need to elect people who will stand and fight for those things. And that's what we need to do. I'm appalled that the Democrats are afraid to get up and do it.
But, I mean, look, the Democrats have been spineless my entire life. The reason that they lost the white male, working class, blue collar demographic is because no Democrat seems to be the guy who's going to stand up and pop somebody in the mouth. You know, the Republicans, I know the Republicans will stand their ground. Even when they're wrong, they stand their ground.
Yep. I actually kind of like your governor.
Fast Eddie? Well, you know, some people, he's one of those guys you love to hate.
Well, see, I don't live in the state, so what I see is I see him on national TV, usually defending the right thing. What I'm saying, though, is we need to get out and even vote for those guys and push them farther and farther and farther in our direction by making it impossible for them to turn away from us.
I'm right there with you. Lou Prince, I appreciate your time again. Vinyl, Vintage Vinyl is the store, vintagevinyl.com, the website. Check it out.
And you can email me through the website. The email will come up, order at Vintage Vinyl, but if you put my name on it, it will get right to my desk.
Alrighty. In fact, I'll email you with the email address you just sent me.
Great.
All right. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, man. Have a good one.
You do as well.
Bye-bye.
This is how we create jobs, by demand. Put money in people's pockets. Get them into the stores. Get them out there. That's how you do it. We're going to take a quick break. Your calls after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Stick around.
All this promiscuity, and I still can't get it. I'm busy being right, so I won't get left behind. God is a Republican.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
In California, a surprising new union movement is growing like a weed, having taken root in a burgeoning economic sector that has enormous potential. Marijuana. The Golden State was one of the first to legalize the use of medical marijuana, and a network of licensed growers, dispensaries, and other related businesses has since flourished. It turns out that pot is a labor-intensive product, and the producers, distributors, and retailers of weed have become something of a hotbed for local job growth. These workers, as in any other industry, need a unified voice to achieve a living wage, decent benefits, training, job security, upward mobility, and other elements of a shared prosperity that create a middle class. In a word, unions. In Oakland, the first step toward a unionized workforce for medical marijuana businesses was taken this May, when about 100 retail employees voted to join Local 5 of the United Food and Commercial Workers. With a depressingly high unemployment rate, Oakland officials cheered this introduction of good paychecks, which will allow families to spread their increased incomes through the local economy. Then, in September, Local 70 of the Teamsters Union added to Oakland's marijuana momentum by signing up about 40 gardeners, trimmers, and other skilled workers who were employed by a local business that contracts to grow pot for medical marijuana patients in the area. The Teamsters negotiated a 2-year contract with the business that provides a $7 pay hike, health coverage, paid vacation, and pension, the kind of jobs that can sustain a community. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, federal law still outlaws marijuana, but common sense state and local laws are showing that by literally going to pot, such legalized grassroots enterprises can give people and their communities an entirely new high.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Daily news, politics daily news reports that President Obama's health care overhaul has survived a legal challenge in Michigan, where a federal judge said Congress does have the authority to enforce a provision that requires people to get insurance. Now, what I've been saying all along is, look, I think health insurance is one of those things that you have to be a citizen in this country. This is not an option. This is not a I choose to be a free rider kind of thing because I'm the individual and I don't have to do it. Again, we have laws in this country that say, you know what, if you get sick, you get hit by a car, you fall out of a tree and break both your knees, whatever it is, you know, you're picking your nose with an axe and you cut it off, you go to the doctor and they have to see you. As long as we have that, you should have to have some type of protection. Look, we're not going to, as a society, and it's never going to happen, as much as, as much of a libertarian as I can be at times, and I can say, you know, if someone's dumb enough not to carry insurance and they fall and break their neck and they should lay there and die, I can't do that. I'm not quite that libertarian. But the reality is we're not going to let that happen. So what has to happen is we have to mandate that people protect themselves. Anyway, the ruling today by U.S. District Judge George, good luck on this, Karam Steeth in Detroit was a blow to the Christian legal group, the Thomas More Law Center, which filed the lawsuit along with four individuals. The judge rejected their claim that insurance mandates and the financial penalty if someone skips coverage are illegal under the Constitution's Commerce Clause, according to the Associated Press. Stee said Congress was trying to reduce the overall cost of health insurance by requiring participation. In fact, he said, quote, without the minimum coverage provision, there would be an incentive for some individuals to wait to purchase health care until they needed care, knowing that insurance would be available at all times. He went on to say, as a result, the most costly individuals would be in the insurance system and the least costly would be outside of it. And he, you know, the judge said, look, this would lead to a system of higher premiums for the people who were in it. And I absolutely agree. This is one of those things that we have to have. You have to have coverage, in my opinion. No free riders. And this is something I think the conservatives should be on board with, Jake. We don't want free riders. We don't want people getting something for nothing. We don't want those downgrades. We don't want them. We want them to be responsible, decent citizens of a country that we... No? Am I missing something?
No, you're not missing something. It's a very simple concept. Doesn't it offend you, it offends me that a religious group is fighting a reform, no matter how minimal, still is going to save lives over the next couple of years in this country? Doesn't that seem to me convoluted morality, or am I wrong on that? Now, you and I are not, how can I say this and be accurate and not offend anybody? You and I are not deeply religious, but we both understand, and I think we both got from our religious upbringing, much as you like to nail the Catholic Church, and me in the Protestant Church, you know, taught us basic religious and Christian Judeo ethics. And to have a religious organization, a religious group, fight a bill which would do what Christ would want us to do, I find that offensive. Or am I missing something?
I find it American Christian. It's got to be that. You know, it's this weird kind of. And look, you know, I'm as spiritual as anyone. You know, I just don't flaunt it. Religion is an organization. Religion is a business. Churches are businesses of promoting spirituality, and I'm okay with that. But, you know, you look at this, and again, it's a religious organization doing it, which is kind of dumb to me. But here's the thing. There are other suits. There's one in Florida, one in Virginia, still to come. And this one, according to these Thomas More Law Center, they're going to take to the Federal Appeals Court. So, again, this is the first step in this. And we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what happens, Jake.
And when
Florida comes up with something different, or if Virginia comes up with something different, and eventually it's going to end up in the lap of the Supreme Court.
Or is this a roundabout way for the conservatives and the big money people to get around to health care reform? I'd like to know where their money comes from. Be very interested to find out.
I'd love to know where.
Follow the money.
Yep, absolutely. I would absolutely love to know that. Here's a real surprise for you. Stupid people voting for Republicans. Wow. An AP GFK poll shows whites without four-year college degrees prefer GOP candidates by twice the margin of the last two elections. The poll conducted last month found this group favoring GOP hopefuls 58% to 36%, a whopping 22-point gap. Compared with better educated whites, working class whites tend to be older and more conservative. Groups that traditionally lean Republican are uneasy with the young president's activist governing. I love how they spun this, his activist governing. No, it's not activist governing. What it is the people voted, said, you know what, we want health care. The people voted, said, we want the banksters restrained. That's what the people said, and the politicians. Maybe we just aren't used to politicians actually going and trying to do what they ran on. And I say trying to because he didn't do what he ran on. And there are a bunch of reasons for that, starting with the letters G-O-P. But he's not an activist. He's an activist president. Yeah. And your point?
We're harking back to the campaign, but really, he gave us hope that we would have responsible government, the kind of government that we want. But yet, and I understand the right wingers and the Tea Party people would say that's socialism and communism. Well, that's nonsense. That's just.
And they're a very small minority.
What you want? What the American people wanted? They saw a government that wasn't responsible, that wasn't respecting them, that wasn't respecting, wasn't representing their interests. Wasn't protecting them in the workplace, wasn't protecting them when they put money in their 401ks. They saw their government going out and getting into wars which they didn't approve of, or even worse, being misled into, and they wanted a government that was responsible for their needs, which is what the Constitution said it's supposed to be.
Well, what we got a GOP chairman who is representing.
Right,
he was representing, yeah, Sir Bling Bling himself.
Well, Mr. Bling Bling tries to be Bling Bling, but doesn't do a very good job.
Speaking of crazy people, Todd Palin, Syrah's other half, fired off an email to Alaska GOP U.S. Senate candidate Joe Miller, complaining that Miller refused to say whether his wife, Syrah, is qualified to be president. Let me lay this out for you. Let me help you here, Todd. She's not. She wasn't even qualified to be governor, but somehow she got elected, and she realized that. I give her credit. She realized she wasn't capable of being governor, so she quit. Now, granted, she quit to make a whole bunch of money because she's a gold digger, but, you know, that's a whole other part of this. Anyway, he writes to Joe Miller, Syrah put her backside on the line for you, Joe, and yet you can't answer a simple question. Joe, please explain how this endorsement stuff works. Is it to be completely one-sided? Are you kidding me? When did Todd get off his snow machine? Anyway, Joe Miller revealed that his wife drew unemployment benefits. Let me say this again. Joe Miller the guy who thinks unemployment compensation should be unconstitutional, his wife drew unemployment benefits. There's no punchline. That's it.
So in his world, in the Joe Miller world, like, does that mean that that's grounds for a divorce because she's doing unconstitutional?
No, things. No, that's grounds for stoning.
American Taliban.
There you go. There you go. So you figure that one out. And it's, you know, like the guy I met at the Tea Party rally who, you know, smaller government, less spending. He's collecting unemployment. You figure it out. We're going to take a quick break. Your calls. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this. Stick around!
Smith Show, changing America for the better. The Rick Smith Show on Country.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, right now, a Mississippi judge ordered an attorney right now to recite the Pledge of Allegiance in court. Get this. This is the kind of country we're moving towards, folks. Where your freedom of speech? Nowhere. This judge down in Mississippi told the attorney, you either recite the Pledge of Allegiance or we're locking you up. And what do you think they did when Chancellor Talmadge Littlejohn ordered Lampley, he ordered him jailed in Tupelo, and there he is, sitting in jail. The Northeast Mississippi Daily Journal reported that Chancery Judge Talmadge Littlejohn told a court audience to rise and say the Pledge of Allegiance. People in the courtroom said Danny Lampley, of Oxford, stood but did not say the words. Records show Lampley was booked into the Lee County Jail at 9:40 a.m., and released at 2:30 p.m. on judge's orders. So you don't say the Pledge of Allegiance, they lock you up, Jake? Is that contempt of court? And you know the thing is the Pledge of Allegiance in the Constitution? No, it was a propaganda tool. I mean, it was an advertising tool to sell more flags back in the 1800s. That's what it was. It was a marketing ploy. So I guess if I don't, you know... Think of some of the what are some of the marketing ploys that are out there? You know, I'm loving it. Oh, I'm stand up and repeat the McDonald's theme song. I'm loving it. If I don't do that, am I going to go to jail when the corporations completely take over?
Well, I think he overstepped his bounds.
You think?
Abuse of power. I would be. I'll tell you one thing. If I was the man that was thrown in jail, there would be some nasty lawsuits on their hands, I guarantee you.
But, you know, what scares me is there are people in this country who go, oh, yes, I should put him in jail there, lock him up for not saying the Pledge of Allegiance. Right there in the Constitution, say Pledge of Allegiance before court starts. I'm sure there are. I'm sure there's somebody out there who thinks that. There's that look again.
Probably the same people that thought that, you know, prayer in schools was in the Constitution also.
It's not? You mean all those years?
Not the Constitution I checked. Now, maybe you have a different one, Rick.
It's in the kind of solution. Constitution. It's in the constellation. That's where it's at. It's the constellation. I read that. Another interesting story. An elections commission in Connecticut will soon decide if Ann Coltergeist will face felony charges over allegations of voter fraud in 2002 and 2004, according to Brad Friedman at bradblog.com. The State Election Enforcement Commission will vote on October 14th to decide whether to pursue charges based on a complaint made by Daniel Borchers, an activist with Citizens for Principled Conservatism. Borchers cited a report in the New York Daily News alleging that Coulter illegally voted in Connecticut in 2002 and 2004 by way of absentee ballot from her home in New York. So, if she did this, this is an absolute case of voter fraud. What should we do with our conservative talking head?
I guess my question is this politically motivated? Is he angry at her, or is there some...
I don't care.
Is there some legitimate... I'm asking, is it a legitimate charge?
Well, you know, the New York Daily News...
Or is he just trying to embarrass her?
Well, all of that. He's trying to embarrass her. He probably doesn't like her. He probably wants to see her go down. There's a whole bunch of reasons that probably...
I can't imagine anybody that wouldn't like Ann Coulter.
Well,
she's such a swell gal.
Yeah, well, you betcha. But here's the reality. You know, the thing is she committed what Brad Blog is saying, Brad Friedman's saying, she committed a third degree felony of voter registration fraud.
And that
along with a first degree voter fraud misdemeanor when she lied about her residence and then knowingly voted in the wrong place.
And what's the maximum?
Doesn't say.
Doesn't say.
But, and I didn't look for it, and I should have. But this is an example of someone who thinks she's above everybody else. And she flaunted it. And what always gets you caught is you end up trying to flaunt it. And she did. You know, it was one of those deals where, you know, I'm better than you. I'm smart, and I'm going to get away with this. Well, you know what, honey? Maybe you and Paris can share a cell.
Well, she's always...
Maybe the two of you could make one of those green, grainy movies together. Might be the only decent thing you do in your life.
She's first in line to try to embarrass somebody. So there is a big circle in life, Rick. Eventually, yep. It comes back.
And, you know, I saw Paris Hilton's green, grainy movie. It's all right if you like girls who look like teenage boys. But...
I don't know that we want to... Okay.
Maybe I've gone too far.
That might have been a little bit of TMI there.
All righty. Well, the National Republic Senatorial Committee, the NRSC, is yanking its latest TV ad in support of Republican businessman John Reyes off the air in West Virginia's Senate contest after a casting call for a spot seeking actors with a, quote, hickey blue-collar look. So we need some really stupid guy. Some guy who looks like he's been rolled over by a truck, beaten up, all liquored up, and hickey. What exactly is hickey?
Well,
someone explain to me what hickey is?
Okay, I'm cheating a little bit here because there was an expose on MSNBC.
Oh, an expose?
Yes.
It just wasn't a report? Entire expose?
They were exposed. I mean, actually, you know where they made the commercial? South Philly.
Nice.
And
so you found a hickey person in South
actors.
Philly?
Yeah, but it gets better. They wanted them to wear semi-dirty hats.
Okay.
Cam
2 racing oil?
Flannel shirts.
All right, yeah. I get that.
Jeans and, you know, a little bit of slang and using the, you know, the hokey language. And
hokey? Is that an official term, hokey?
Well, it was supposed to, you know, kind of, actually it made, what it did, and I think it's going to backfire. I think that's why they took it off. They were actually making fun of the people of West Virginia.
You know what the funny thing is? You know, I don't know that most people who would have, if they would have produced the ad, I don't think most people would have thought they were being made fun of. I don't think they'd have known it.
Well, they actually absolutely were.
But I don't think that the people who would have seen it would have noticed.
And again,
hey,
I know,
look,
I know
look, you, Ma. Hey,
I know you better.
Hey, stupid like me.
You you better sit down on this. They're trying to nationalize this election and tie the Democratic candidate for governor with Obama and the Democratic administration. I don't know how you do that, but they were making an attempt to do that. I think it's pretty funny, though, that it was from South Philly.
Can someone explain?
They were professional. They were professional.
I know when I was in high school, I used to get a couple of hickeys every now and then. But can you explain what hickey is? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Exactly what is hickey?
Hokey.
Hokey? Is hokey part of it, too? Hokey, hickey, hockey?
It's hokey.
I get it.
Kind of like
it's
not too bright country bumpkin. That's just my take on it.
You sure about that?
That's just my take on it.
All right.
I can understand why they took it off. I can understand why they took it off.
Well, you know, I guess you got to do it. Or maybe they were looking for a Tea Party person.
You know, Chris Matthews.
I'm the Tea Party people.
They had a Republican on, a Democrat on, and they interviewed both of them. And he was pretty aggressive, saying, "Come on now you're basically making fun of these people."
I'm sure they didn't ask Larry. I'm sure they didn't ask Lusty Larry Craig to come on.
Let me be clear, I am not gay. I never have been gay.
I got a new toy.
That's an oldie but goldie.
Yeah, well, you know.
I believe that's enshrined in the Hall of Fame.
But I just think that's funny. You know, and not that the guy who's running for governor over there and or running for Senate, the former governor, or he's still governor, but not that he's much better.
Well,
but I look at this
he's
guy.
Actually losing the polls. You know,
we're going to put a robber baron in the Senate from West Virginia, a guy who said, "I made my money the old-fashioned way. I inherited it."
In one of the poorest states in the country. Go figure.
But he's going to give us a job. He's going to give us jobs because rich people give us stuff. Rich people give us jobs. I mean, how mind numbed do you have to be to think that way? But then again, like I said, it's not that Manchin's much better. Not much better at all. Jeez, oh man. You know, why is it that we do that? Why is it as a working class we tend to let ourselves be, you know, just be hoodwinked into these candidates who, for all intent and purposes, are our sworn enemies? I mean, this is a guy, this John Race, who's basically advocating for going back to the good old days when we could use kids in the coal mines. You know, granted, they lost a couple fingers as breaker boys, or, you know, they got smooshed by the door. But, you know, every once in a while, you know, you got to have that. That's how you thin the herd. Because there won't be so many mouths to feed. You see, we can get rid of some that way. And if they weren't smart enough to get their fingers out of the way, well, they'd need them anyway. See? That's how it works. Jeez, oh, man. Are we really, really going to make this giant swing back, this giant U-turn back to the days of liberty of contract? Well, I'm going to make my own deal. Yeah. You're going to make your own deal to get screwed. And the worst part of it is you're taking me with you. I'm going to make my own deal. Every person I've ever heard say that has always made a bad deal, and it's end up costing somebody else a whole bunch as well. But you know what? They're happy. They got screwed, but they're still happy because they made their own deal. Oh, please. If there is a God in heaven,
well,
please do not let
every
us.
Now and then, every now and then, there is a ray of hope in Nevada. And this could be crucial. In Nevada, one of the leaders of the Senate in Nevada has come out and endorsed Harry.
Let's hold that. We'll talk about it after the next segment. We're going to talk to Jack Wagner right here. Stick around. Right back after this.
Blue
in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Northrop Grumman has begun layoffs at Avondale Shipyard on the Gulf Coast. It plans to destroy 5,000 jobs and close the shipyard, despite a Navy announcement last month that it plans to keep Avondale busy with work. The AFL-CIO says another 7,000 jobs will be lost when the 5,000 Avondale workers are laid off. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says Northrop Grumman is taking advantage of tax loopholes that make it more profitable to cut those jobs than keep the facility open.
One nation is America. America is a union of 50 states. We are all united together in a common cause of trying to lift all Americans to a better life, to better lives for their children.
Metallic Lathers, Local 46's Bobby Ledwith on the One Nation movement. Ledwith says good jobs are what the voters want, and a big political surprise is brewing.
It's going to be a big surprise in November, and I think it's going to be reminiscent of Harry Truman in 1948.
On Wednesday, worker activists blew the whistle, literally, on what they call Rite Aid's health insurance scam. In New York, Los Angeles, and Bellingham, Washington, activists converged on Rite Aid corporate events to protest hiking health care costs to workers that are 28 times higher than the actual costs of the program. Are inmate laborers and prison workers recklessly being exposed to toxic materials through a government e-recycling program? Jesse Russell takes a look.
A new report on the website fairwarning.org reveals that electronic recycling operations at federal prisons have resulted in inmate laborers being exposed to high levels of toxic materials. One of the biggest recycling operations is in Elkton, Ohio, where Fair Warning reporter Myron Levin says the U.S. Bureau of Prisons has paid about $1 million to settle a grievance over hazardous duty pay. The settlement was paid to prison employees after being reached in October of 2009. The article comes just days before the U.S. Justice Department is expected to release a report that will allege federal prison officials ignored safety precautions. The allegations are being raised at 8 federal prisons that use the for-profit government-owned corporation, Federal Prison Industries. The Bureau of Prisons would not go on record regarding any of the allegations because the matters have been dubbed either pending or confidential.
While the jobs may only be seasonal, it is good news for some workers who have been unable to find employment. Last week we reported on a number of businesses upping their seasonal hiring, and today we have more to add to the list. Kohl's Department Stores has said it will bring aboard an additional 40,000 workers this holiday season, while UPS plans to add 50,000. In more permanent hiring news, American Airlines announced Wednesday it would be recalling 800 laid-off workers. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, you know, I do, and I got to be honest with you. I'm happy that somebody's watching. I'm glad that someone like Jack Wagner is watching where our money's going. As Auditor General, Jack Wagner recently called for a state moratorium on the creation of new charter and cyber charter schools until the General Assembly and the Rendell administration fix a flawed funding system that bears no connection to the actual cost of educating children, according to his press release. He goes on to say it is costing taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars a year in questionable spending. A special report issued this week, Wagner said the funding problem was accelerating at an unaffordable pace. Jack Wagner on the phone. Jack, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rick. It's great to be back.
You know, I'm looking at this report that you've just put out on charter schools, and I got to be honest, I'm not a big fan of charter schools, and some of the stuff that you've laid out in this, especially with the funding, gives me another reason not to be so in favor of them.
Well, as you know, charter schools is a new phenomenon in the country, and they've been in existence in Pennsylvania for about the last 12 or 13 years. And they have grown dramatically from 6 or 7 charter and cyber charter schools to about 135. 67 of those 135 are in Philadelphia. But what we have looked at is not whether or not the quality of education is there. We have looked at the equity and the funding formula. And what we have found, Rick, is that it's a flawed process where taxpayers are losing out. And as a matter of fact, even school districts and charter schools have unfair funding formulas in place that create a tremendous inequity in the educational process.
You know, one of the things you've written here is you're saying that taxpayers now spend $1 billion a year on approximately 73,000 children. And my math, that's over $13,000 a year per student in these charter schools. It's my understanding in the public schools we're spending around, I guess, about 8,500 to 9,000. Is that correct?
It is somewhere in that number, but you have to keep in mind the money that goes to the charter school, and the charter school is a public school, created under the approval of the school district and the Department of Education.
Right.
The funding that goes to the charter school is a formula based on the average cost per student at the school district where they came from. And generally speaking, the charter school gets about 70% of that cost. 70% because another 30% is kept for management, administration kinds of purposes. The problem, Rick, with the $1 billion is that there is a quarter of that $1 billion, approximately $225 million, that is reimbursed to the sending school districts, which represents a premium payment for every charter school student in Pennsylvania. In other words, every charter and cyber charter school student is costing Pennsylvania taxpayers an additional $225 million a year.
Well, that seems kind of stupid to me, Jack.
Well, it is, and that's what I'm really trying to identify in the report. There is inequity, as you know, in the educational funding formula for the 500 school districts.
Correct.
It gets more complicated and more convoluted when you add the charter school system to it. So what I'm saying in my report is that the governor, the General Assembly, and most importantly, the Secretary of Education needs to get this right. Other states in the country have, and Pennsylvania so far hasn't.
Well, I mean, here's the reason that I'm against it, is what you're doing is you're fracturing the pot. The money that goes to education is now being split among these different winners and creating a bunch of losers, in my opinion.
Well, there's good charter schools and there's not so good charter schools.
Sure.
The same, as you know, exists with public schools. And what we need to do is to fix the educational process in the best interest of the children,
absolutely,
not just throw more money at it.
But you know,
unfortunately, that's what we've been doing.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, $1 billion to educate 73,000 kids, couldn't we have better spent that $1 billion, and this is just my opinion on this, by improving the public schools and improving the education for all the kids instead of splintering things off? I mean, I look at this cyber charter thing. We're paying a bunch of money for this cyber charter program, and there aren't all that many people in it from what I understand, and what we're paying is huge. And there are no buildings. There's no brick and mortar there.
Well, that's true, and that's what we emphasize in the report, that we believe there's a clear cost of a cyber charter school student and a regular charter school student. But the same amount of funding to the child, no matter which school it is. Consequently, there is a built-in inequity in that funding process. But keep in mind, Rick, every school district is adopting new methods of education, including the use of technology and computers, which is what a cyber charter school does. And that's a good thing, because kids today are very capable of learning in ways that we older people traditionally have not learned. And if you have, for instance, of serious weather conditions like we did last February, it's good for a school district to have that capability.
No, I agree with that. So what's the solution? What is Jack Wagner saying we should be doing?
What I'm saying is that, you see, I slightly disagree with you. I think it's good to have alternatives in the educational process. If a parent thinks that a school district is unsafe and they don't want to send their child there, but they have no other choice, the charter does give them an alternative. But it should not be structured such that there is inequity in the funding process and it's costing taxpayers more dollars. And that's precisely what's happening today. And therefore, as the Auditor General, as the independent fiscal watchdog of the Commonwealth, I have to bring that to the attention of everyone. And that's precisely what I'm doing, because the General Assembly needs to fix this problem. The Department of Education has to show leadership. And so far, they haven't.
Yeah, I absolutely agree there. But here's the thing. You know, you brought up the fact that a parent may think the school district is unsafe. Isn't that the job of the school district to get that under control instead of creating lottery winners who may end up being able to, hey, I got my child into this charter school, but everybody else in the school, you know, never mind them. That's where my problem with this whole charter school thing is that we're creating winners and losers by who can get into these schools. As opposed to who can.
I couldn't agree with you more, Rick. If you have a problem, you have to correct the problem at the source of the problem.
If you want to read the report, go to auditorgeneral.state.pa.us. We'll put a link up at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Are you calling for a moratorium on any more charter schools? Because they've kind of exploded, and the money that we're spending on it, according to your report, has kind of exploded, too. I think you said something like 183% increase in the funding there?
Yes, Rick. What we have called for is a moratorium on the creation of new charter schools. Again, there are 135. I'm not saying that a parent that wants to send their child to a charter school today or a cyber charter school still can't do that. In other words, you could add the number of students at existing schools. But we need to get this funding formula correct.
Absolutely.
So it's not costing the taxpayers additional dollars. It presently is. And with the serious fiscal problems facing Pennsylvania, a $4 to $5 billion deficit next year, we cannot afford to be wasting taxpayer dollars. We cannot afford to be spending more than we need to spend. And that's presently what we're doing. That problem needs to be corrected by the governor, the General Assembly, with leadership by the Department of Education.
And we will be pushing to do just that, because I got to tell you, I saw that number, $13,000.
You still with me?
Yep, I saw that number, 13 grand, and I said, why can't we do that for all kids? Jack, I appreciate your time, buddy. Look forward to having you back again real soon. Jack Wagner, Auditor General. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Okay, Rick. Take care.
It is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
For many, the 8-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized, and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the 8-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80 80,000 workers turned out to support the eight-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, eight innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. Four of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody, everybody, let's get into it. Get stoned, get it started, get it started, get it started. Let's get it started. Let's get it started in here. Let's get it started. Let's get it started in here. Let's get it started. Let's get it started in here. Let's get it started.
That's my favorite part of the whole song. That's my favorite part of the whole song. I'm sure you care.
Now I know why you sang bass.
Yeah, I didn't sing bass. I played bass.
Oh, you played bass. Okay.
1-888.
You occasionally sang, though.
1-888. Yeah, when I was on fire. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. You know, you look at this, and just talking with Jack Wagner, you know, some of the things that didn't add up to me. Now, he was talking about, in his report, $1 billion to educate 73,000 kids. That's right around 13.5 per kid. And the fact that you've got the average around 8,000-9,000 in this state, you know, if that's the case, if we're going to pick winners and losers, why don't we just spend 13,000 on every kid? Why don't we, instead of splintering off into cyber charter, which, you know, you want to homeschool, homeschool. I don't want to pay for it. I'll be honest with you. Instead of splintering off into all these different directions, why don't we fix the problems that we have? And, you know, over the past 5 years, and this is what Wagner writes in his report, there has been a 183% increase in state taxpayer contributions to charter schools. 183% increase. What if we had that kind of increase for everybody? That's my point in all this. And if you want to read the report, you can go to auditorgen.state.pa.us to take a look at it. Some good information. So take a look at that. I think it's worth a read. It'll give you a little information on what we should be doing. The Republicans keep saying that when they take over, they're going to block health care reform. They're going to repeal it because it's, you know, who knows what their claim this week is. But according to Reuters, Republicans could keep their promise to stop health care reform, even if they cannot repeal it, simply by blocking legislation needed to pay for it. That's pretty much what we've been saying from the beginning. What they'll do is they'll just starve it. And then you and I will be pretty well screwed. All the steps forward that we got will just wither on the vine. I mean, there are hundreds of laws that's exactly what they've done. They've completely defunded them. What has to happen is we have to wake up and we have to get out and vote. You know, I'm not happy with this health care bill, but right now it's the best thing we've got. It's a starting point for me. And until we start making this better, I mean, like, you know, I go back to Medicare. And, you know, my grandmother has done very well with Medicare. You know, she's had a hip replaced, a knee replaced. She's had a heart valve replaced. You know, at 70-some years old, she's 82 now, but at 70-some years old, in the private market, good luck finding health insurance when she needed that heart valve replaced. Good luck at that.
No, pre-Medicare, let's be honest, most of those people die.
And
they die.
There's part of me that says this is the goal of the Pat Toomeys and the Republican Party. They want people who were unlucky in life, who weren't able to hoard, to save a bunch of money, to just basically expire so that they can consume the resources. And what I find amazing is that we've allowed it to happen. That you don't have work. What is it about our current pay or die system that people are so in love with? You know, I keep hearing this, well, I don't want the government in between me and my doctor. You want a corporate bureaucrat between you and your doctor? You want somebody whose only concern is the bottom line between you and your doctor? Because if they don't approve you, you don't get the treatment, Jake. Yeah. I mean, in this pre-approval nonsense, you can wait. And then the denials. I mean, haven't we had enough?
Well, again, you know, you talk about Frank Luntz on this program repeatedly. They were better at framing what they wanted the public to perceive were the real issues on that national health care debate.
You want the real issue? Pay or die.
That's correct. But how many people other than you and the congressman from Florida, who I love, by the way, who said something very similar to that, Republicans' answer is, you know, pay up or die. But other than that, and you, where have we heard it from the Democrats? They tiptoe around it. You know, they
say dumb things, like Pelosi said, oh, you'll know how good it is after it's in place. No, tell me what it is now. Tell me how it's going to make my life better. And this has been the failure. Right there. This has been the failure of the Democratic Party to make people's lives better and to make people know that their lives are better. I mean, it's one thing to say we passed this, and it did this. Tell me how it affected me. Tell me how it made my life better. When we talked with Lou Prince here a minute ago, the guy who owns Vintage Vinyls, the small businessman, when he said he got that credit card statement and he got that credit card thing and said, you know, you could take a loan. You could take out a couple of bucks, like you've done a couple of times, that has the thing on the bottom, real small print, 3% interest,
yep.
Or $75.
Some of them are 5.
Well, again, but he said, you know, back, you would see the real small print, tiny, yep. Itty-bitty print. Most people didn't even know it was there. Like he said, that law that they passed, they put that in 18 fonts.
Yeah, but it gets better. That's just off the top. And okay. Then, because they call that a what do they call that?
A cash advance.
A cash advance. That rate that might be 10% is all of a sudden 22-23%. Oh, they get you. You pay handsomely for that.
And, you know, the thing is they know that people are going to extend. You know, it's like these furniture places and like these electronic places that were running no payments till 2012, no payments for 5 years, no payments. Well, if you don't pay it off by the end of the no payment period, most people don't know that what they do is they go back to the very beginning and you pay every cent of interest during that no payment period. It's got to be paid off at the end.
And they're smart enough to know that people who use that either have a sudden emergency, which happened to me, and you have no choice. So they're going to really sock it to you.
And again, it comes back down to the fact that as Americans, we have not saved enough. We don't have an emergency stash. We don't have reserves. And, you know, I love the fact, you remember here in the state, we kept arguing about the state had a rainy day fund. And, boy, the conservatives were just up in arms that how dare the government hold our money? How dare they hold money in reserve? That's our money. It's ours. Ours, darn it. Well, you know what? We hit crisis. And you know what came in handy? Having a little reserve money.
The rainy day fund, oh, I don't know, precludes something like a tax raise. A tax increase, which is exactly what you had to do. What are you going to do?
You know, and this short-sighted, end-of-my-nose way of leadership that we've been going through in this country for the last 30 years has at some point got to stop. Look, I love this country as much as anybody. But the reality is we are no longer, in my opinion, the number one place. If you want to argue with me, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, because, look, we've got an infrastructure that's aging. We've got an education system that's failing. We've got a healthcare system that a good number of citizens can't get access to. And even those of us with health insurance, we're struggling to get by. You know, when you have someone who gets sick and they have insurance and they still end up filing bankruptcy because they can't afford the deductibles and they can't afford the co-pays and they can't afford the prescription drugs and everything else that goes along with it, tell me that that is not a broken system. And you know it is. And we're paying twice to three times as much as everybody else. And we're not getting the services. We're not getting the services. Now, if you can, you can pull money out of your pocket like Limbaugh or Beck or Gates or Buffett, this is the place to have the world class healthcare. When you can dig into your pocket, I can shell out $100,000, no problem. Yeah, we got the best healthcare in the world then. But for you and me, good luck on that.
You just said the buzzword. I've had conservatives tell me, "Wow, you don't know what you're talking about, Jake. We have the best healthcare in the world." Oh, really? By what barometer? Longevity? No. Coverage? No. Cost? No.
By what barometer? Infant mortality? No.
Infant mortality, one of the worst in the Western industrialized world. So when you look at the real four or five top factors that you really judge, and we're talking about organizations have done this, not people who are prejudiced one way or the other. You have organizations who are looking at it strictly as a study to find out the actual situation. And they have come to the conclusion, look, we're what, at 36th, if I remember? I mean, all this, you know, I was heavily involved in that, and that's going back a year, and I knew all those numbers. I believe it's 36th in the world. 36th, but what do you hear? Oh, we have the best health care in the world. No, we do have some of the best doctors in the world. We do have some of the best facilities. We do have some of the best technology. But as a system, absolutely not. It's the most expensive in the world. And we have a third of our people who are underinsured. And and those are old numbers, by the way. How long have we been saying 100 million for the last couple years? The recession has gotten worse. You have people who are losing their homes because of healthcare. Those numbers are actually very conservative.
Well, you're almost up to 51 million uninsured right now.
They were just raised. We used to figure 48. Now we're over 50. Some people say 51. I've heard 52. At this point, we really don't know. Because when they readjust the figures, a lot of times, Rick, it's 6 months after the fact.
Right.
So as of today, it could be closer to 53.
And as I've always said, look, you cannot possibly be even in the middle class in this country without health security. And think of health insurance as health security. Our system is a reactive system. You know, I talk to friends, when was the last time you had a checkup? Well, you know, 2 years ago when I had to have it for work. Is that really the kind of checkup you want to get? You go get a blood test. Go get, you know, your cholesterol check. Go get all that stuff done. I'm fortunate that I have a relationship with a family doctor who I just think the world of. I think the guy is a fantastic guy. He runs a nice small practice. I shouldn't say small. He's got a number of patients, but you know, he knows us and he follows our lives. So when, you know, like the other day, my wife went and had this little thing on her back. He said, we better get that checked out just in case. It's nothing now, but you know, let's just go get that checked out. Cause maybe we can get that taken care of with an office visit instead of, you know, waiting 5 years down the road until it turns into cancer. And then you got a real problem. See, this is what I've been trying to say from the beginning. We need to change the way we think of healthcare in this country. And what's happened is what we've done for the insurance companies is we've taken all the risk out of it for them. We've taken the elderly out of it because they can't pay the premiums, and we've taken the young people out of it, the children. And the people in the middle, they're prime picking. And then they were allowed to deny for pre-existing conditions. Then they were allowed to deny for rescission. Just picking and choosing the ones that were profitable and leaving the rest to taxpayers to cover. Look, if we're going to cover the senior citizens, because we know people use health care in the first 5 years and in the last 5 years of their lives. If we're going to do that, if we're going to take on the biggest risk, shouldn't we as a society have everybody pay into the pool to help alleviate those costs? Why are we so in love with a pay-or-die for-profit system that enriches a handful of people? I mean, look at Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is a genius on Wall Street. But where did he make his money? Berkshire Hathaway. An insurance company, a healthcare company.
Well, you know, the Republicans and those who opposed it were brilliant at playing off one against the other.
Fierce.
In other words, fear of, you know, if they get healthcare, they're going to take it away from you. I've had people tell me, oh, I want the healthcare reform. Most people are going to be going to the doctor all the time.
That's the idea.
Well, that's the idea. Hello, people don't. They allow They're like little puppets. They allow themselves to be
marionettes
used against their own self-interest. They don't understand if you have a system like that, where when you have a minor ailment, you can go to the doctor and get it checked out.
Oh,
you don't have to go and wait in an emergency room and wait 12, 14 hours and maybe go only when it develops into something serious. That people don't understand, if we have a preventive maintenance system, we can actually bring down the cost, oh, I don't know, Rick, maybe for everyone. Gee, what a unique concept. What I don't understand is the lack of education as to what the rest of the world has. You know, and I think you can relate to this. When I grew up, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and we were taught the United States is the best. It's the greatest country, and at that time it absolutely was. Therefore, we assume as we grow older, unless we educate ourselves, that the United States on all major things is the best in the world. Well, it's not. And healthcare certainly is not one of them where we are the world's best. We are far from the world's best. And it's not only a humanity thing. It's not only the fact that people are needlessly dying, which to me is abhorrent ethically. But let's look at it in pragmatic terms. It's affecting not only our economy, it's affecting our long-term economic health because we're losing jobs because of it.
Yep.
And the Democrats have done a lousy job explaining that.
I sure have. We're going to take a quick break. Your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Working man like me. I ain't never been on welfare. That's one place I won't be. I'll be working. As long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
In California, a surprising new union movement is growing like a weed, having taken root in a burgeoning economic sector that has enormous potential. Marijuana. The Golden State was one of the first to legalize the use of medical marijuana, and a network of licensed growers, dispensaries, and other related businesses has since flourished. It turns out that pot is a labor-intensive product, and the producers, distributors, and retailers of weed have become something of a hotbed for local job growth. These workers, as in any other industry, need a unified voice to achieve a living wage, decent benefits, training, job security, upward mobility, and other elements of a shared prosperity that create a middle class. In a word, unions. In Oakland, the first step toward a unionized workforce for medical marijuana businesses was taken this May, when about 100 retail employees voted to join Local 5 of the United Food and Commercial Workers. With a depressingly high unemployment rate, Oakland officials cheered this introduction of good paychecks, which will allow families to spread their increased incomes through the local economy. Then, in September, Local 70 of the Teamsters Union added to Oakland's marijuana momentum by signing up about 40 gardeners, trimmers, and other skilled workers who were employed by a local business that contracts to grow pot for medical marijuana patients in the area. The Teamsters negotiated a 2-year contract with the business that provides a $7 pay hike, health coverage, paid vacation, and pension, the kind of jobs that can sustain a community. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, federal law still outlaws marijuana, but common sense state and local laws are showing that by literally going to pot, such legalized grassroots enterprises can give people and their communities an entirely new high.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. On Tuesday, the State House approved by a vote of 159-38 a self-defense advocate measure that they're calling the Castle Doctrine. Basically what it's saying is, look, if someone's going to attack you, you have the right to use whatever force necessary. As opposed to the old law that said that you had to retreat. The question is this a good thing? You know, and I look to Texas. If you remember, we talked about the John Horn or the Joe Horn scenario. And I got a couple of clips I wanted to run through, just to kind of remind us of the situation. Joe Horn was a guy who his neighbor's house was being robbed. And he called the police and he said, "Hey, my neighbor's house is being robbed." And on the phone, you know, he goes through this whole thing.
Hey, 911, what is your emergency?
Burglars breaking into a house next door.
So, you know, he's made the call. He's on the phone with the guy.
I've got a shotgun. Do you want me to stop him?
Nope, don't do that. Ain't no property worth shooting somebody over, okay?
So, you know, he tells the cop, he goes, "Look, you know, I got a gun, like you heard. Want me to go stop him?" And the guy goes, "No, we got somebody on the way. Don't worry about it. You know, protect yourself. Do whatever you got to do."
I'm going to let him get away with it. I can't take a chance on getting killed over this, okay?
No.
I'm going to shoot.
So, you know, he's in his house. He's really under no threat whatsoever. In his house, the criminals are in the neighbor's house. The police are on the way. He's done what I think any good citizen should do. So then comes this.
He's coming out the window right now. I got to go, buddy. I'm sorry, but he's coming out the window.
Don't go out the door. Mr. Horn.
Damn it, they just stole something. I'm going out the window. I'm sorry. I ain't letting them get away with this. They stole something. They got a bag of something. I'm doing it.
Mr. Horn, do not go
outside the house. This ain't right, buddy.
You're going to get yourself shot if you go outside of that house with a gun.
You want to make a bet?
Okay, stay in the house. I don't want you going outside, Mr. Horn.
Well, here it goes, buddy. You hear the shotgun clicking, and I'm going.
Don't go outside. My gun, Rick.
Oh, you're dead.
So there's Joe Horn. There's the story. To me, this is the question about the Castle Doctrine. I understand defending yourself. I absolutely understand. Someone walks into your house, onto your property, threatens your life. You have the right to defend yourself. I'm right there. You know, my question is, and he was actually acquitted of this. A jury in Tennessee acquitted him for, you know, shooting two guys in the back, shooting them dead. As the police were pulling up, mind you. So, you know, look, am I going to mourn two criminals being killed? No. My concern is that we end up turning into the Wild West. My concern is what happens if that cop gets there 2 seconds later and ends up, you know, or walks around the corner. You know, there's a lot of questions here, which is why this week, either tomorrow or early next week, we're going to try and get a representative to come over here and talk about the law. Now, look, I am not in any way, shape, or form against somebody defending themselves. But if you look at this scenario with Joe Horn, he wasn't defending himself. He was defending his neighbor's property. He was defending his neighbor. I'm okay with that. But to shoot somebody in the back, I'm not sure.
I guess two questions. One, did they have a gun?
It turned out they did not.
If they do not have a gun, and this man, you see him coming out of the window, doesn't it make sense if you want to do something, and this is reasonable, just go outside, shoot that gun off. Now, if they have no gun, do you think that they're going to...
I don't know.
That robber and I hear that man, and I know he has a shotgun, and he's 50 feet away, he's telling me, "I have this shotgun, you better get out of here, I don't want you seeing... I don't want you to steal anything out of here.
There's two of them.
Okay.
I mean, what if they both got guns and you give them that warning? I understand. My problem with it is you interjected yourself into a situation where you weren't...
And he obviously wasn't under threat.
You weren't under threat. The police were on the way. You know, my fear is that once you pass something like this, it then becomes, now it's my right.
I guess.
Because the clip that I didn't play and I didn't get to is him saying it's September 11th, it's my right. Because, you know, in Texas on September 11th, a couple of years ago, they passed this type of a castle doctrine where you don't even really need a reason to shoot somebody on your property.
It wasn't his castle. It wasn't his property. And here's another thing.
Well,
he said you're dead before he pulled the trigger.
Well,
so he had intent.
Yeah, I know.
Now, if you're going to go that far, you could have winged him. Are you telling me he couldn't have winged him?
I don't know about that. Then they come back and they sue you. That's how weird of a system we've got sometimes.
I'm not so sure about that, Rick.
Well, I mean, clearly you heard him. He went outside with the clear intention that he was going to kill those people.
He said you're dead.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean? To me, that means he's going to kill him.
So it'll be interesting. I'm looking forward to having a conversation with the legislator about this because, you know, I would love to hear the conversations that they've had.
What was he charged with?
Well, he was charged with...
Was he charged with murder or manslaughter?
Manslaughter. And he was acquitted.
See, I don't... I'm sorry.
That's Texas.
I mean, he's either innocent or he murdered him.
He was innocent. Well, they're saying under the law, under that law, that he was within his rights to do what he did.
Manslaughter means you killed somebody under mitigating circumstances. What's mitigating about saying, hey, I'm going to kill you, and then he proceeds to kill him?
Well, the mitigating circumstances.
He wasn't under threat.
Being you were protecting your neighbor's property.
Now, you show
would
me
you
that.
Want would
you
want,
show me that legal concept?
Well, would
Rick.
You? Well, it's part of their law. Their law in Texas.
It does include your neighbor.
No, it doesn't include the neighbor. But
that's my point.
It includes your person, and then the question is: do you have a reasonable fear that you could be harmed? I'm not defending it. But this is the slope you go down when you start passing things like this.
And they went. The intent of the law was to allow you to defend yourself and kill somebody who is putting you or your family at risk.
I don't know if it was to kill somebody, but it was to defend yourself and to stave off harm.
But they apparently had that recording, and I'm sure they played it in court,
yep,
where he said, well, I'm not going to let him get away with it. He's playing, he's playing
judge
and jury.
And executioner.
Local sheriff. I'm the sheriff, and you're not coming into my neighbor's house. Well, who appointed him God? I'm sorry. Wow, you talk about a slippery slope. They're not going down it. They're running down that slippery slope.
So then I guess the question that I would have for you then is, where would you want to have Joe Horn as your neighbor if someone robbed your house?
He sounds a little flaky to me.
But, and again, it's one of these questions that, you've got to somehow come to grips with. You know, if it is my house and let's say somebody's home or,
Here's one.
What if he shot my kid?
Now, this is what I might do if I see him. I might go get a baseball bat, and I might give that man, this is
But what
just
if they've
me.
Got a gun? What if both of them have guns?
How can you carry something out at the same time hold a gun?
You can put it in your waistband.
Well, I'd make sure
What if they stole the gun?
Well, you're putting out a lot of ifs here.
But no, here's
I
the
think
thing.
You're reinforcing my position. He shouldn't have gotten involved in the first one.
He did what he was supposed to do.
He called the police.
He called the police.
That was adequate. I would even go so far as go out and shoot that gun.
Nah, I don't know about that.
Oh, come on.
Because now you're putting yourself in a dangerous situation. Because what if both of them then have guns?
But Rick, wait a minute.
If you've got a criminal who's willing to break into your house.
But you have a criminal that I'm sure they're savvy if they're career criminals.
And what if they're...
They're savvy and they know the law. And they know that man who just shot that shotgun under the conditions of what they're doing stealing can shoot them.
But what if they got two strikes? Under the three strikes and you're out. What if they got two strikes and they got nothing to lose?
Yeah, we're riffing this to death.
At the end
of the day, once you allow that man to get away with going on his neighbor's property and killing two people, I'm sorry.
He was actually on his own property when he shot. So he shot from his own property.
Defending his neighbor's home.
Well, no, probably the street because they were walking away from the house. They had already stolen stuff.
Point is he's not defending his own property. He's defending his neighbors.
There are some who would say, I'd like to have a neighbor like that to watch out for my house. And the people like me go, I don't really want people watching.
Do you really want a man with a shotgun who...
I got a bunch of people with shotguns who live around me.
Who seems to think that the restraints on him are very... very thin and narrow.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation, and next week, I think either tomorrow or early next week, we'll end up with one of the guys.
Well, here's a scenario. What if he wounds or even kills somebody else, an innocent bystander?
That's my problem. What if my kid walks out the door or something? Yeah, there's a lot of questions.
And depending on the shotgun, that spray shot, that's going all over the place.
Yeah. So we'll see. We will find out next week. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right here. We'll be back to wrap this up.
And I don't believe that God wants me to give my money to someone like you. But I do believe in what a crazy man can do.
Yeah! Scott Right Wing. Just Race. The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well?
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're standing in welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time.
It's interesting you talk about food stamps. The AP has said former House Speaker Newt Gingrich is advising Republican candidates on November's ballots to frame the choice for voters between Democrats as the party of food stamps while selling the GOP as the party of paychecks. The AP reports with a month to go before the elections, Gingrich brought his branding effort to Minnesota on Wednesday. He raised money for Republican gubernatorial candidate or nominee Tom Emmer. You know, Emmer's the guy who said we should do away with the minimum wage for restaurant workers. Yeah, that's a good way. That's a good way to stimulate the economy. He thinks that by cutting their paychecks, you're going to end up hiring more workers. And it's true. Look, if I didn't have to pay a minimum wage, that pesky minimum wage, I could hire a bunch of people. If I could pay somebody a buck an hour and they were desperate enough and we could make an economy of people who are desperate enough to take a buck an hour, so much good for me. World they live in. And what's interesting to me is you had old Gingrich on that Greta Van Susteren show. And he said, well, I don't understand how, you know, the Democrats can turn a dollar of food stamps into $1.79. I just don't understand that. I don't understand how they figure that out. Well, Mr. Gecko, Mr. Newt's a lizard, right? Crawls on the ground on his belly, right? Isn't that what a newt is? What kind of a parent would name their kid Newt?
I'm not sure. Someone who's from Hummelstown, Pennsylvania, apparently.
Yeah, well, do you have any newts in Pennsylvania? Are there any of these lizards walking around in Hummelstown?
I mean, it's a couple miles from here. I can check it out.
Do that for me. Here's the thing. He doesn't seem to get the basic concept that if you give help to people who need it, that they're going to spend that in the local stores. And that reverberation of them spending it in the store and then the store owner spending it to their distributor and their distributor spending it to the producer creates a reverberation effect. So every time it's spent, it creates another job, which puts money back into the economy, and you have a snowballing upward. It's spiraling up. That's a good thing. What the Republicans want is they want to end all that. And I've been saying without those programs, without food stamps, without unemployment insurance, without all the things that we got in the New Deal, we would be looking at another depression. And what's interesting is you look at this new report from the AP, who's saying that poverty is becoming a suburban problem. And you look around most areas where real nice areas, there are homes that are empty because the people lost their homes. And I go back and I question how many of the people who have lost their homes, Jake, have lost it because the banksters stuck it to them and didn't do the right thing and threw them out of their house without filing the right paperwork, and there was nobody there to fight for them. Anyway, the AP writes, battered by the downturn, America's suburbs are bearing the brunt of poverty among the working age that has climbed to its highest level in almost half a century, creating strains on dwindling safety net programs focused mostly on inner-city poor. A pair of analysis by the nonprofit Brookings Institute paint a bleak economic picture for the 100 largest metropolitan areas over the past decade and into the coming years, when the U.S. poverty rate is projected to edge towards 15%. Some of the findings that they came up with is poor people's request to nonprofit groups to help buy food has gone up. So, you know, like when we do our food drives for Project Share, they're not just seeing poor people, Jake. They're seeing people who, you know, 2-3 years ago would have never imagined themselves having to ask for help. Almost half of the nonprofit groups serving suburban poor report that they have lost substantial government and private sector aid. So, you know, look, here in December, we're planning on doing another one of our Hungry and Homeless for the Holiday food drives. And we hope that everybody comes out and participates. But here's the thing. I understand that people are struggling. And it's going to be a lean food drive, I think, because, look, you know, you got to worry about feeding your own family first. And in this tough economic time, the food banks, especially our friends over at Project Share, they do a fantastic job of squeezing a quarter until the eagle screams, because they have to, because it is their mission, Jake, to help feed people and to help them. You know, the one thing I really love about Project Share, and I don't want to turn this into a whole commercial for them, because that's not what I want to do. What I really think is great about their organization is that you can go there and work for a day, you know, stocking shelves or helping people get their needs. And that gives you some sense of, I'm not being given this. I'm working for it because I don't have a job or I can't afford it, but I'm working for my keep. And that's what I think is a fantastic component.
That's
to that
pretty,
organization.
That's pretty unique among like-minded organizations. I honestly didn't know that, but that's a great idea.
You know, because one of the things I've always said, especially when you're talking about charity groups, and which is why I think, you know, with the food stamp programs, I think, you know, people have pride. I think all people have.
There are some people absolutely needed who will not take welfare because of the stigma,
right,
and the way they were born
and if
raised.
You, and if you give
they're
them,
they're ashamed.
If you give them that opportunity to say, you know what, come help us, come work here for a day, and we'll pay you for your day's labor. See, to me, that's a terrific thing. And what makes me absolutely disgusted is you look at somebody like Gingrich, who I don't think has ever missed a meal in his life.
He don't do too many push-ups from the table.
Saying that, you know, people who, you know, the Democrats are the party of food stamps. Yeah, because we care if people starve.
I mean, again, the poor, those who are hungry, they don't really have a lobbyist. It's very much underreported. Most Americans are not aware of it. Even in the economic downturns, you know, there's a lot of people who think, wow, those people that are getting into government programs just lazy and shiftless and cheating the system, and they don't want to work. Unfortunately, that's far, far, far from the truth. If I remember 2 years ago, the numbers just for, I know this is in Carlisle, but Harrisburg Central, the Central Pennsylvania Blood Bank, they helped 26,000 just around the Capitol, and that was 2 years ago, and it could very well be larger this year. That's a substantial number.
Yeah, you know, and Gingrich says, well, you know, most Americans would like to get a paycheck. Most Americans would not like to be forced to have food stamps handed out by liberal Democrats. You know, those people who don't have a choice? I think back to my mother. And I got to be honest, I don't know how the woman did it. I honestly don't. One of the things I've always said, my greatest fear in this life, from this point forward, is to have to look into my children's eyes and know that they're hungry or know that there's something I can't do for them. That's my greatest fear. And I remember as a child, I remember going to the cupboards and there being nothing there. And it's not like back then you could go to the store and, hey, you know, here's my credit card. That didn't happen. There was nothing there. And there was nothing she could do about it. And in the times where she lost jobs, and a couple of them were my fault because I got sick. How do you deal with that, having to swallow your pride? And back then, you used to have to go down to the welfare office and you had to sit for a day and you had to fill out forms and it was degrading and it was... And they'd give you these book of food stamps, and I'm sure you've seen them. And you'd have to go with these cartoon money pieces of paper into the store and have the people, you know, giving you the evil eye. And I will never forget the first time I used one. I had to go to the store because my mother was sick, and I had to buy something with these food stamps. And I was about 8 years old. I was about as old as my daughter. And I got to tell you, I was never more humiliated in my life. I've never felt that talked down to, that degraded in my entire life. And I swore as a child that if I had kids, they would never do that. But I think back, man, you know, and there's nothing wrong with it, in my opinion. There's absolutely nothing wrong with feeding your children. And to have someone like Gingrich say that, well, you know, they're the party of food stamps. You're right. You know what those food stamps did? They kept me alive. Because if we lived in conservative world, if we lived in his world, who knows?
Well, what they fail to realize or don't care for short-term political gain, if we don't have programs like that, we're basically throwing away a segment of our society. And it's not just throwing them away. Those are people who could contribute in a substantive, substantial way to our society and be good citizens and make this country better. And if we just write them off, we are writing off part of our nation.
Exactly what I have done. Exactly what I have done with my life. Thanks for being here tonight. We'll see you back here tomorrow, 9 p.m. to midnight, Monday through Friday, right here. Thanks very much.
It's coming from the wind. You've been listening.